show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to ask the question, are corporations people? Do they have the same rights as living, breathing human beings? Can't throw them in jail, can't kill them. They live forever. They can take out loans for hundreds of years. I don't think they're really people, but the corporate world believes they are. The wealth class believes there are. We're going to talk to somebody who said, you know what? I'm going to try and use that for my benefit. I'm going to incorporate. I'm going to take my corporate papers with me to work. And we're going to drive in the high occupancy lane. Because I got my corporate person right here with me. Interesting angle. We're going to find out how he did in court yesterday, arguing that, and you know where the plans are from this point. Also going to talk about guns. Yes, heard an awful lot about guns, especially from the folks at the NRA, the No Reasoning Allowed group, Not Rational Again group. Interesting news. I mean, I've been seeing a lot of really bizarre things. Nowhere near the actual topic. A lot of chest thumping, a lot of finger pointing, a lot of screaming at each other, a lot of name calling, gun nuts. I hear a lot of that. Gun idiot. I hear a lot of that. Not much in rational discussion. And, you know, for me, you know, okay, play your little game, you know, go back and forth, whatever you got to do. But how do we make sure that we keep our kids safe? Do we put a cop in every classroom? Should we have a gun in every classroom? Boy, who's going to pay for that? We don't want a teacher in every classroom half the time, but we want a gun. Interesting thoughts. So we're going to talk about that. Also, privatization on the horizon, still selling off stuff that belongs to you and me, we the people, for pennies. We're going to talk about the lottery privatization. And speaking of privatization, the education report card out by the wealth class's handmaiden, as she pushes for policies that has everything but students first. Again, you know, this is one of those report cards, and you know, I've had a lot of bad report cards in my day. This is one of those report cards I'd have been happy getting an F minus on. And because it's, the whole point of it is, how destructive can you make your education policy? How fast can you privatize? How fast can you destroy the public education system in pursuit of profit? I mean, that's really what it's about. And we're going to talk about some of the information that came out recently about some of the studies going on. Also going to talk about the banks, the settlements, a couple more settlements to talk about. AIG, can't wait to get to that. Boy, ungrateful, no good for you, no what's. And more sales gimmicks later in the program for the simple-minded. You know, get you all lathered up, get you all tingly in the panties, all wadded up, and ready to spend. So you show those you know whatever. Nonsensical. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got a number of emails yesterday about the whole gun thing, so I want to talk a little bit about that later on in the program, get your thoughts as well, because, look, for me, I'm in line with the idea you should have the right as a law-abiding citizen to be able to protect your home, go hunting, carry a gun if you want, do what you got to do. But you got to be responsible for it. And the other part of this is I don't know that we need, you know, military-type weapons. Sorry, just don't know. Don't buy it. You can take that argument down the road and say, well, you know, the Founding Fathers, they wanted us to be able to overthrow the government. Good luck on that. Does that mean now my neighbor can have a nuke? Because government's got one. Can they have a tank? Do we have anti-aircraft? Do we have any of that? No. So some reasonable, rational thoughts. Please, policymakers, you know, get your head out of the special interests and into how do we make sure that the kids in the classrooms, how do we make sure that they're safe? When I send my 10-year-old, my 6-year-old off, when my 4-year-old gets into school, how do I make sure that they come home at the end of the day? Because I didn't really talk much about what happened in Connecticut, but it, you know, it broke my heart. I mean, I've got 3 small kids who, at the end of the day, if they didn't come home, it would devastate me. No parent should have to go through that. The other part that worries me is, are we training our children to live in armed camps? You know, my gun nut friends who do believe we should have a cop in every classroom. We want a gun in every classroom. What kind of a society? I mean, I already fear that our education system has turned into a regurgitation system. I already fear that it's turned into a knowledge-based system without much critical thinking, designed to keep people in line, push the buttons, but never ask why. When you put a military presence in those rooms, when you put an authoritarian-type presence in every classroom, what are you doing to that next generation? Don't hear many of my pro-freedom, gun-toting, God-fearing. I don't hear much out of them on that. So as we have this discussion, and we need to have it, we need to think about what the long-term ramifications are. But our media just likes to focus on the craziness. And I don't know if you saw Alex Jones on with Piers Morgan, a poster child for mental health screening, in my opinion. But again, the shtick he wanted to do there, that he wanted to do that. But we're going to talk about that as well. Some breaking news, breaking important, very important breaking news heard right here on the Rick Smith Show. That's right. I was reading the Patriot News. evidently, Punxsutawney Phil made a trek to the farm show today. Yes, yes. Maybe Phil's there to do some reporting on poverty, since the people at the Patriot News did not. And, you know, I'm going, is this news? Really? Is this news? No, it's not. I don't really care about Punxsutawney Phil. But the farm show seems to be consuming, and maybe it's just because it's all we're hearing in the news, is that somehow the farm show is the all-encompassing moment. But I had breakfast this morning with my wife, and I heard folks behind me complaining about the parking. And it should be free. And I go, well, I'm sitting here thinking, well, why should it be free? You got to pay to get in, right? No, it's free to get in, so you don't want to pay anything. And all I heard then was whining about, well, we should be able to park closer, and they should build a parking garage, and a whole bunch of stuff. And I've gone, you do understand that this is owned by the state, and they've got, you know, things that they never, it goes nowhere. Let's go to the phone line. It's got Bill on line one. How you doing tonight, Bill?
I'm doing good, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. Hit me. What's going on?
Well, you know, I've been listening to your discussions about this gun situation, and there's a couple of things I'd like to bring up to you.
Hit me.
As a matter of fact, I agree with you. I'd say 80% of the time, but this is one that I really gotta disagree with you on. One point I'd like to bring up, which I don't think you're aware of.
Okay.
As far as I know, our intelligence gathering networks, ever since the Patriot Act, one of the targeted areas that they've had for some time now is a national database on prescription drugs. And they know who's taking, types of drugs, which have, in most of these situations, been found to be, a factor. It certainly was the case with the shooting in Connecticut. It was obviously the case. I mean, I've already heard some data on it as far as the case in Colorado or the Batman shooting. And I know you've addressed this to some degree, but I really think this needs to be the main center of focus.
I agree with you. Mental health is a huge component in this. I agree with you.
But I'm saying they already have the information, so I don't know why that isn't being targeted more and discussed more. And again, why are these particular people who clearly shouldn't have access to anything more than, you know, plastic scissors or something, why are they anywhere near guns? That's the key question right there. But, I think it really needs to be emphasized, too, in the case of the Connecticut shooting. They like talking about this AR-15, which I've always had a problem with liberals and anti-gun people when they talk about so-called assault rifles. They're assault rifles in name only. They look real bad, but an assault rifle is a military gun that is select fire. In other words, you throw a switch on the side, you can fire full automatic. You can't do that with an AR-15.
No.
But here's the point. Yes, his mother had one, and he stole that after he murdered her, along with the other guns. But he left that in the trunk of the car. What he took into the school were handguns. And the big question in that situation I have, more than anything else, how the hell did this kid, why was he allowed in the school? His mother didn't work there. If you recall, that was the first thing they said. His mother was a kindergarten teacher. Well, she wasn't. They said he attended there. He hadn't. So, you know, there's a lot of ballyhoo on both sides of this thing. But one thing I think is very important to remember, and I have been in a state of anger ever since the Patriot Act.
I'm with you.
Because that was a direct attack on our constitutional rights. You know, and the thing of it is, whether we like to take it seriously nowadays or not, when the Bill of Rights was discussed and finally written and voted on and passed, the Second Amendment, the primary purpose of the Second Amendment was not a militia, was not home defense. It was stated by people like Jefferson plus many others. If there's ever another tyrannical government, don't forget, we just got rid of a tyrannical government. If you have a tyrannical government again, you can and will have the means to keep it off your back. So we don't like to think of that nowadays as being a possibility. And in fact, it really isn't a possibility for the average gun owner. Let's face it, they're not going to stand up against tanks or planes or anything else. But I mean, I think it's very critical to understand that.
And it's also critical to understand that the well-regulated militia part was also giving the government, if you read the Federalist Papers and what Adams wrote, it was about, you know, being able to discipline a militia that on the federal level. They didn't want standing armies. They didn't believe in them.
Well, yes, and understand, everyone was basically in the militia, I don't know, 15 to 60.
Exactly.
And
But
the concept of the militia was not, you know, necessarily your own self-defense. It was a collective gathering should our country again be threatened, you know, by the British, for example, which it, of course, again was in 1812. But, I mean, you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular, as far as I'm concerned, really isn't subject to a lot of interpretation. And when people start talking about changing it, I've got a huge problem with that. And let me just say one other thing in regard to that and why I feel so strongly. You know, my family, certain members of my family, were deported to Russia after World War II. You know, some of them died in the Gulag. I know that history very, very well, very, very deeply, both firsthand, and I've read every book I could ever lay my hands on. And the first thing that ever happened in all of those countries, and I remember when they did it in Vietnam, too, was the very first thing they did, was to disarm the people, and then that all hell broke loose. And so, those people were totally defenseless, Rick.
So let me ask you, last question before I have to take a break.
Sure, sure.
Is there any regulation, anything that you see that we could stop this? Anything that you would agree? The high capacity magazines, any of that stuff,
That is me.
I'm just asking.
Technically, that's another meaningless point because the reality of it is that if you really wanted to do something horrible like these characters have done, you'd wipe out a lot more people with a sawed-off shotgun with double-aught buck than you would with an AR-15. An AR-15 is a .22 with a long shell and a more powerful round. It's not an effective weapon, really. The problem I have, again, with all this is, as you certainly know reading history, and I know you have a very good grasp of our history, one situation leads to another.
Right.
And when you start chipping away at rights of any kind, you know, it just opens up a Pandora's box. I mean, I'm sure you, like me, weren't happy with Bush with a lot of things he did. I have been very unhappy with Obama with this NDAA, which he said he was not going to sign, but then he did. You know, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is really horrible in its implications and possible uses. You know, what you have to remember, what I always have foremost in my mind, our present leaders may be bearable, and in some cases we may like them. We have no way of predicting what might come down the road.
Yeah.
We just don't. And if we put laws in place that restrict our personal abilities to even defend ourselves in any way, shape, or form, all right, the guy right now I don't think is going to do anything really neat. Who the hell knows what it's going to be like 20 years from now?
Yeah,
and as far as guns in the school, no, I don't think you need a cop in every classroom, but I mean, when I grew up, I remember, you know, probably most of the male teachers in my elementary school and high school were combat veterans of either Korea or World War II.
Yeah, but did they have a sidearm with them? No, and the answer is no. The worst thing, I had a nun with a pointer. Bill, I appreciate the call. I appreciate the input. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rick. Take care.
Call back anytime. Quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Barely a week into the new year and economic policies loom large. The AFL-CIO says with 155,000 new jobs added in December, America still needs new policies to really make a dent in long-term unemployment. Austerity, the Labor Federation says, is a foolish path because austerity kills economic recoveries. The AFL-CIO has joined with La Raza, SEIU, the Center for Community Change, the Economic Policy Institute, the Leadership Conference, and other groups to advocate for prosperity economics. As the President and Congress confront the national debt, tax policies, and other fiscal issues, the groups have issued a report laying out an alternative to austerity economics. The central conclusion of the report is that there is no inevitable trade-off between creating a strong, dynamic economy and fostering a society marked by greater health, broader security, increased equality of opportunity, and more broadly distributed growth. The report says when government plays a more active role in the economy through investments in education and science, economies are more dynamic and innovative. The report, called Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, says we can afford to build America's productive capacity, reconnect earnings and economic security to overall productivity, and preserve a strong social safety net while building a robust economy. The report recommends major infrastructure investments in guaranteeing all qualified students the chance for a college education. The report also calls for empowering workers to engage in collective bargaining so that wages rise with productivity and economic security for working people is strengthened, the opposite of austerity economics. The merger of two nurses' unions will likely lead to a new fight for Kaiser workers in California. Jesse Russell reports.
The California Nurses Association has forged an alliance with the National Union of Healthcare Workers. The merger comes after the expiration of a non-competition agreement between the CNA and the Service Employees International Union. The CNA doesn't plan to renew that agreement and likely signals a move by the new NUHWCNA to launch a new effort to convince 43,000 Kaiser Permanente workers to leave the SEIU. The NUHW lost an election against the SEIU in 2010, but in late 2012, the National Labor Relations Board found that Kaiser had violated federal labor laws by withholding raises from workers who had been fomenting a break with the SEIU in favor of the other union. A new election will take place this year. The CNA represents 85,000 healthcare workers in the state of California.
In New York City, the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1181, is working to avert a possible school bus strike while trying to protect jobs. Thousands of bus drivers and their supporters rallied over the weekend. The union says the city is cutting costs by bidding out jobs with private companies, and without protections in the new contract, many experienced drivers could suddenly lose their jobs. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our Commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
Half the prosperity. I guess if you keep trying to sell off all the state assets, maybe you'll make a couple of bucks. Who knows? You know, one of the things I loved, it was right before Christmas. You may remember Governor Corbett as a rationale for not setting up the state health care exchange. I got to be honest, a failure on his part, I'm quite happy with. But I think the federal plan is going to be far superior to what Republicans like Governor Corbett would have come up with. But I find it ironic, and I find it interesting that his reasoning for not setting up the exchange was that he didn't have enough information. And it was Christmas Eve, if I remember right, in the Philly Inquirer, that he wrote, without fully understanding the parameters, price, and future stability, the risks involved in taking on the challenge currently outweigh the benefits. So he's saying, look, I need to have more information. Yet, here we are. Two days away from having to give this private for-profit corporation an answer. We're going to allow them to take over our lottery, yet we don't have all the information. We don't have all the data. There's a lot of unknowns, a lot of questions that I have, a lot of questions that legislators have, and I find it even more ironic that the company gives the state a deadline of the 10th when we're going to see one of the first hearings on it scheduled for January 14th. Kind of interesting, which is why I've asked Dave Filman, executive director of AFSCME Council 13. He represents some of the workers there that work do a great job for the lottery. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
I appreciate the opportunity, Rick.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, looking at the governor's rationale for not setting up the state's health care exchange, didn't have enough information. Shouldn't he use that same logic for what he's talking about doing with our lottery?
We sure don't have a lot of information when it comes to the Camelot Group, that's for sure. But we did have an extension of time to present a counterproposal. We had met at the end of November with the Commonwealth. Our original counterproposal was due on actually Christmas Eve. We asked for and was granted an extension of time, and today we presented that counterproposal to the Commonwealth at noon. And we have it on our website. We have been very transparent about this, exactly what the lottery is about, what the lottery has done for not only the taxpayers but the senior citizens of Pennsylvania, only lottery in the nation that devotes all of its proceeds towards senior programs. And we found a lot of fault with the Camelot proposal with as much information that we could get because they were very protective of some of this because they haven't got an agreement at this time. We're not sure if it's going to happen on the 10th or if it's going to go beyond the 14th hearing, which we hear that seems to be the situation now. So we did find a lot of fault within that, and we presented that today.
Before we get into your proposal, because I have a counter-proposal, leave it the hell alone. It seems to be working quite well. It's benefiting seniors in this, and it's as I've seen, the profits never better. In fact, 2% overhead, which is what we're paying for it. Jesse White, the state representative last night, told me the Camelot does this in another area, and they have double the cost of operating it. So we're going to lose money in operations. Am I missing something here?
No, you're exactly right. And, a corporation is only in business to make money. They're going to make money for their stockholders. They're going to make money to keep the operation. They're going to have high salaries for their executives, which is typical of a corporation. And where does that money come from? Well, all of the money that's generated from the lottery is from the sales, primarily, of the either the instant lotteries, the daily numbers, the Mega Millions, all of those games that are out there. Currently, we're looking at a company that wants to come in here from the United Kingdom, from England, and take over the operation and try to skim as much money as they can out of wherever it could be, either from the lottery proceeds, from the senior programs, and I can talk a little bit more about how that works. But the bottom line is They're going to make money. Our bottom line in the Commonwealth, we don't make money. It's a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, and they're going to make money. And we already know. We've seen this movie in other industries that we've privatized, other things that we've gone after. But it's to me, it's apparent, and maybe you'll agree, that you're going to see money being diverted from senior programs. But more importantly, you're going to see cuts to workers' wages. You're going to see destruction of benefits. You're going to do health care, pensions. That stuff's going to go with future workers in this are going to be done.
I think you're absolutely right, Rick. And what your listeners have to understand is, our lottery has been in place for 42 years. It was signed in 1971, started on place, in 72 with the first games they rolled out. And we have been successful all of these years. In fact, we have been so successful that when the original law was passed in 71, there are like four core programs that they were looking to fund in senior programs. We have now gone beyond that. We had money that was probably should have been going into reserve, but they looked to put that money into other programs. They serve senior citizens. There's nothing wrong with that. But for the administration to come to us and say, oh, by the way, we had some years where we really were cutting it kind of close. Well, it was because either the governor or the legislature, and obviously before Corbett, had put those monies into programs to help the seniors because it was doing so well. But they were cutting the profit margin awfully close. We have that in our report, that if you look over the track record over the years, those are the kinds of programs we want to continue to fund, even if it means cutting it close, because the only ones that benefit from this are senior citizens, and they're certainly the ones that need it today.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I looked at the governor's proposal when it came out, and one of the main argument that he made was that because of the recession, and he doesn't say because of the Bush recession, he just points to 2009, there was a dip in lottery sales because people didn't have the money to spend.
Sure.
And he's saying that the reason we need to do this is Camelot has agreed that they're going to level out the profits. So help me if I'm getting this wrong. If we have another big recession, is his argument that privatizing this, Camelot will make up those profits, and we're going to be guaranteed that amount of money? So if, let's say, next year nobody buys a lottery ticket, Camelot's going to come up with $1 billion.
Well, that's what their profit guarantee is, of $1 billion, for a total of $30 billion over 20 years. And keep in mind, this is a 20-year contract with a 10-year option to make it a 30-year towards the end of that time. And what's been touted about a lot, Rick, is there's this $200 million escrow account or guarantee account that they're talking about. $150 million they're going to put up, plus a $50 million line of credit. Well, when you look closely at the private management agreement, the PMA they call it, that's not exactly a dollar-for-dollar piece. There's caps within there. That they would not be able, they being the Commonwealth, if the Camelot doesn't come up, this $200 million isn't drawn down dollar for dollar. You've got to look at, it's on our website, www.afsme13.org. We have all of our proposal there, and we have graphs and charts to show exactly where this thing is missing at this point. Let me talk about another part, Rick. Currently, the law that was passed says that 27%, a minimum of 27% of the proceeds have to go to senior programs. We did last year 29.9%. We went beyond those minimums. In 2015, the law is going to go to 30%. That is going to be a minimum that has to go to senior programs. Part of the PMA, the private manager agreement with Camelot, is that they and the Commonwealth are going to go to the legislator and roll that number back to 27% as it is right now, so that the seniors don't get that extra 3% in 2015, which they're supposed to do, because we rolled it back in exactly the time frame you said, when the economy was tanking and money was kind of tight with the programs and with the money coming in from the lottery. So part of their whole program is actually skimming money away from the seniors and going to the legislator and backing it off. The other part, the minimums, are for prizes. When you go to buy your tickets, especially your instant lottery, there's a guarantee that there's going to be so many $50,000 winners, $10,000 winners, $5, all those things. the law says 40% has to go towards prizes. Right now, we're paying 61% towards prizes. Now, who benefits from that? Well, the general public who plays the games.
Absolutely.
Now, what do you think the corporation's going to take a look at and say, huh, all we have to pay is 40% in prizes? Let's see how we can trim back that 61%, maybe not all the way down to 40, but maybe to 45%. So all along, or all around, when you take a look at this thing, it's just they have these opportunities to clip money away from either the senior programs or from the prizes that the taxpayers would win.
Oh, here's the bottom line, Dave, and at the end of this, no matter, I don't care what's thrown out there, a corporation is in business to make money. They've had to look at this and found a way that, hey, we can profit off of this. We're going to make a ton of money back. We're going to make the money we put up plus a boatload more. And where is that going to come from? And as you pointed out, it's going to come from seniors. And as I've said, it's going to come from workers through wages, pensions, and it's going to come from our economy, because that money, that profit, is going to leave Pennsylvania. And as Jesse White pointed out last night, it's going to go out of the country.
And he did a great job. I listened to that last night. And another thing that is a misnomer out there is that the people are members. We have 175 members over there, plus there's another almost 220 total that work in lottery, that they're guaranteed a job for a year. That has never been brought across the table. There's been no guarantees at all to anybody in the lottery division. There has been an attempt to say you can apply for a job at Camelot, but you bet your butt that the benefits and the salaries are going to be way, way down there, because they want to take care of their stockholders. They don't care about the employees. There's been no offer to this union for keeping anybody on board other than a core of 70 people. We don't even know who those 70 people are. Are they 70 managers that have to be there, because federal law says you can't give the keys completely to a private outfit? You have to maintain the core operation within the state. So that has to stay here. But with so many unanswered questions, with the fact that we've got a private corporation coming in from another country, taking over a very successful operation we have in the state of Pennsylvania.
Before we get to your counterproposal, do those jobs have to stay here? Is it possible for them to offshore those?
I believe that part of the PMA talks about 80% have to be from Pennsylvania. Right now we have 100% of the folks that are working there are all Pennsylvanians. Additionally, and they've danced around this, they've set up headquarters in the state of Delaware. Why?
The loophole.
Exactly right, the Delaware loophole. So already they want to do the business of the state of Pennsylvania, but they don't want to pay the taxes in the state of Pennsylvania. They danced about it and said, oh, it was quick to set up the incorporation down there, but I haven't heard the fact that they've pulled out of there, so they're still headquartered in Delaware. I don't know why they can't headquarter in Carlisle, for God's sake.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest with you. The more I hear about this, the more it stinks. So beyond my counterproposal, which is leave it the hell alone, it's doing just fine, thank you very much, what did AFSCME Council 13 come up with?
Well, basically, it's the things I have talked about. We think that we can continue to expand the lottery as we have before, with the millionaire raffle, with the Mega Millions, the Powerballs. All of those things were expanded before.
Jump in the Keno?
Well, that's part of the deal here. You know, Camelot's throwing out this whole big deal about the Keno and the internet gaming. That is something which actually the lottery was looking at before the casinos came up. And when they were starting to get loaded up for the Keno, the Gaming Control Act went into place, so they backed off of it because of that. I don't know if all your listeners know, the Keno is sort of like a bingo, reverse kind of bingo piece. It's in Maryland, it's in New York. You sit at a bar, there's a TV screen that has these numbers that drop down every, 5-10 minutes, depending upon the cycle. And, you sit there and you can gamble and bet on these, games just as you would the daily number, except it's a lot more, not more numbers, but also it's more frequent. That has a significant amount of money coming in. I believe Maryland, realize about $200 million more putting up the Keno piece.
Wow.
That's part of Camelot's whole deal. It's something that, we could do. However, we also think there's a legislative piece involved with this. As you know, the governor is saying he can do this because it's part of the lottery. It's not like the wine and spirit shops where he has to get legislative approval. We disagree with the point that the Keno machine is like a slot machine. It has what's called a random number generator inside of it. And if you actually go to the Hollywood Casino in Grantville, there are some Keno machines in there. So our lawsuit that we filed last month was to say, wait a minute, if you're going to expand, Camelot's counting on all these profits, especially expanding to Keno and online gaming, we're not so sure that's all in the purview of the governor. That's something that the legislature has to deal with, and I think that's what Senator Brubaker has on the 14th for his hearing, getting into some of that stuff.
I mean, for me, all of this should be done in the open. I want accountability. I want transparency. Yet everything I'm seeing coming out of Harrisburg right now with the folks that are running things, I'm not getting that feeling that they want me to know what's going on.
And it's been like pulling teeth trying to get information. We still don't. We still don't have a lot of information dealing with the technicalities of this PMA. We went through, and I've got two folks, Christy Wolf Maloney is my grievance department manager. Mike Fedor is works subcontracting. They both went through 4,000 pages of documents of prior revenues from the lottery, the PMA agreement, you know, all over the place. And, you know, we got to this point where we were kept looking at this agreement, and it just had so many loopholes in here where Camelot's going to be able to make money. Again, it's either at the expense of the seniors or with the taxpayers who play the games, and they're going to skim some of that money out. Again, keep in mind that when I talked about that $200 million guarantee, Illinois is going through the same thing right now with a guarantee where their private firm, Northstar, did not deliver on that, and now they're in court trying to get their money, which was part of their agreement. We could see that happening here.
Yeah, you know, I look at, and I got two questions left for you. You know, I look at the whole push to, you know, to privatize the wine and spirit shops, you know, basically get rid of anything that government does and now the lottery. How much of this is ideology over reality? I remember the wine and spirit shops. They said, oh, we're going to get $2 billion, and by the time you started, you know, shining a light around, realized we were getting nowhere even close to that. How much of this is ideology over reality?
Well, and that, you're exactly right. I mean, this is, you know, we hear constantly, especially from the state side, the Commonwealth, you know, we've got to run government like a business. We've got to run government like a business. Well, you said it correctly. Here's a department that has just around 2% of administrative costs, has done outstanding for the last years. This year, just made $1.01 billion in net revenues. It's a $3.4 billion operation that has been very, very successful. And, you know, we have outlets all over the place. The lottery reps are out, you know, tracking down new delis or 7-Elevens to try to get them involved with this thing. So it is run like a business, no different than the wine and spirits that wants to say, hey, let us run this place like a business. They make $500 million a year. We're making $1 billion over here. These are the most successful operations the state has fully control over, taking all of the proceeds that are necessary, especially in Pennsylvania, take care of the senior programs, and now they want to sell it off to a company that's going to make money for the next 20 years for themselves.
Yeah, we're really not even going to get anything out of it. I mean, there's not even an upfront payday that we're selling something off, getting something out of it, really. It's my last question I've got, though. You know, as I look at this, you know, again, I look at I want the motives. I want to know where this company is going to make this money. And for me, I look at, you're going to screw the workers over this. It's going to be less wages. And to me, it's a pension ripoff. Back to the ideology over reality. We're going to see a pension fight in the next couple of months. How much of this is the ideology of trying to destroy the state workers' pension fund by pulling more workers out of it?
Well, that's exactly right. You're talking about, you know, hundreds of folks at this point that would be affected by this. We have taken the numbers. We've counted up what Camelot, not only coming in with their management fees, and then we didn't even get into talking about some of the consultants they hired to do this thing, which is millions and millions of dollars. But when you take what Camelot's going to take off, their profit motive involved with that, you compare that with the cost that we have for all of the employees, all their benefits, all of their pension, it's less the employees doing it now than bringing Camelot in to do it.
Bad deal all the way around, Dave. And I appreciate the time. If the proposal at AskMe13.org.
That's it, my friend.
We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on David Philman's name. Take you right there. Dave, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Quick break. Back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Finally, in the 11th hour and 59th minute, Republicans and Democrats negotiated a fiscal reform package, which they touted as the American Taxpayer Relief Act. But if you had been allowed to peek behind the curtain during the deal-making, you would have noticed that the Dems and Repubs were not alone, and some taxpayers were getting extra special relief. Captain Morgan, Bacardi, and other Caribbean rum peddlers, for example, were at the table, picking up a $500 million liquor subsidy. NASCAR wheeled in to win a multi-million-dollar loophole for building racetracks. Railroad conglomerates hauled off a $165 million bundle for maintaining their own tracks. Disney and other fabulously wealthy Hollywood studios reeled in a $75 million subsidy for making movies. And Big Coal mined the negotiation for a federal giveaway to buy safety equipment and provide safety training for their workers. But the big dogs in the room, as usual, were Wall Street hucksters. Tucked inside the reform bill is Section 322, opaquely titled Extension of Subpart F Exception for Active Financing Income. In plain English, that line of gobbledygook will move $9 billion this year from our public treasury into the already overflowing coffers of Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other fiefdoms of high finance. Worse than the giveaway, however, is the provision's purpose. As explained by the excellent watchdog group Citizens for Tax Justice, Section 322 essentially underwrites the financing of corporate offshoring, a $9 billion subsidy for moving more U.S. jobs to foreign countries. This is Jim Hightower saying, Italians have a useful phrase that applies here. Qui bono? Who benefits? Yes, this Republican-Democrat compromise has some good provisions, but deep inside, it's the same old corporate ugliness.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S., Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' right to free speech, take away workers' right to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I look at this lottery thing, and I've had a couple of guests talk about this. What's really interesting to me is that the more I find out about it, the more I don't like it. My visceral reaction to it was negative, because I've yet to find a privatization scheme that has benefited me, has benefited working people. I've yet to find it. And I've yet to have anybody call and say, hey, Rick, you know, when we privatized the airlines, oh, it did us great. What's it done? We've bailed them out time and time again. We've seen mass consolidation. Has it really benefited us? And did we really privatize it? The answer is no. And I heard, oh, wow, you know, the post office. Well, look what we're doing to the post office. And somebody sent me an email and said, well, it took them 234 years and we can't get the post office right. No, post office works pretty good. I put a letter in a box. 3 days later, it's in California for less than 50 cents. And that's the problem. According to my capitalist friends, it should be $2. Because you can send something overnight through FedEx. $15. And I look at what we're doing. This ideology over reality. This ideology over reason. This blind faith belief over fact. And I see more and more of it, where we're just spewing talking points. And the gun debate's another perfect example. Look, I want to have a rational discussion on it. I think I am reasonable on the issue because I do understand both sides. But if your argument is, well, we need to have guns to take on the military, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. I don't have any nukes in my basement. So the question then becomes, how do we make sure we keep our kids safe? I made a suggestion earlier, mental health, right there with you. Probably shouldn't have closed the state mental health hospitals. Probably not a good idea. Probably should have funded a little bit more of that. Maybe we should be looking at what these drugs are doing to people. Right there with you. Let's have that conversation. But I look at all of this stuff, this whole ideological push towards profitizing and privatizing, and it scares the hell out of me. Because I look at the lottery situation. Understand, this is a ripoff on a number of fronts. As Dave Filman pointed out, they are going to take money from senior programs. And he told you how. They're going to roll back the amount of money 3%. Right there, boom. They want to introduce a new game. We could have done that. We still can. They want to profit from that. They're going to get rid of the state workers, which is going to do a couple of things. One, it's going to take away their collective bargaining rights. It's going to take away their contract. It's going to make them at-will employees, which, as they pointed out, some in Delaware. So you're going to see less wage, less health care, less pension. Oh, yeah, pension. And to me, pension is really important because you look what the private sector has done to pensions in this country and what we've allowed them to do, what we've allowed the wealth class to do to us. They're trying to do it. They're honestly and truthfully, they've already won the private sector pension game. They've already bankrupted it. They've already stolen all the money out of it. They've already put the responsibility on the back of the taxpayer. They've already done that masterfully. And, you know, the whole, for me, the Romney nomination for president was a perfect opportunity to talk about what happened to that pension system. People like Romney, and look, he did what the game allowed. He did what we let him do by voting for politicians who said, yeah, well, go ahead, sure, we're going to, well, for special interest, yeah, we'll give you that. Give me $5,000, I'll pass a law. So what they do, they saddle these companies with massive amounts of debt. And then they ran them through bankruptcy. And what are one of the first things that go away in bankruptcy? Oh, those pension obligations. Even though they had used that pension money already. And one of the schemes that I love is when you see these big companies cutting off divisions. And a nice scheme, nice scam, not real hard to figure out. When you cut off a division, and this is what they were doing all during the 80s and 90s. You got to understand the game. The game is big company spins off a division, say 100 workers, and they overfund that pension the umpteenth degree, but they raise the price of the cost of the business. So you put $500 million extra dollars into that pension fund. You sold off to that subsidiary to another company that you probably own a good share of. overfund that pension, but, of course, jack the price way up. Now you've got that cash from the pension fund. Then you saddle that company with a whole bunch of debt because you overpaid for it. And then you run them into the ground, you take them through bankruptcy, and then you write off that pension. Workers got screwed. It's all gone. And you got the money. I mean, they replicated this time and time again. It's how the game's played. They want to do the same thing to the public sector. And what they're doing is, okay, we're going to privatize the lottery. Let's shoot that off. Boom, that stops. There's no more people paying into the lottery. No more. Now the money's going over here. Now we're going to start paying pension money over here that, you know, hey, you may not see. We'll give you a defined contribution that after 5 years you're vested, and then you'll get the other contribution part. But if you don't make it 5 years, where does that money go? Oh, yeah, it's an obligation that they don't have to fund because they're paying the CEOs. And again, this pension, this lottery deal, no limits on how much the CEO gets paid, no limits on executive compensation. You know, one of the other dirty little secrets of our pension system in the private sector, the much beloved, much ballyhooed private sector, is that the pensions that the bigwigs get aren't actually funded. They're a ripoff of your pension and mine. All of this, you know, I go back to how many people had 401ks during the Bush collapse, or as I called them, 200.5s, because mine got cut in half. How many people went through that? I mean, I looked at my statement, I almost cried. And now here we are, you know, 4 years after the fact, I'm pretty much back to where I was 4 years ago, but I've lost 4 years. I was reading a book that pointed out that the CEOs of some big companies, like Comcast and GE and some others, and a number of others, you know, you're talking about the executive class who never loses. They actually, while my 401k and your 401k was being halved, they actually saw huge jumps. Why? Because theirs is guaranteed. The wealth class doesn't lose. The game, understand, is rigged. All of this nonsense going on in D.C. about all the fiscal cliff and all the debt ceiling, it's all BS. We're being ripped off. We're being fleeced. And you've got these puppets that we call politicians funded, you know, by the wealth class. They're doing what the wealth class wants them to do. You know, I went home last night. Found it kind of interesting. I went home and I turned on C-SPAN, which I got to stop doing because I need to get more sleep. But there is Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. And anybody who knows the Rothschild name, she's married her third husband, his third wife. He is Sir Evelyn Robert de Rothschild, member of the Rothschild family. She's on there talking about capitalism. And a new capitalism. Oh, it's inclusive capitalism. Because even she's waking up to the reality, uh-oh, it's going to come for me. And what's amazing is how we keep bailing out the very rich and how they keep telling us how wonderful the system is for us. Because she started off her spiel by, capitalism has brought millions of people out of poverty. I go, yeah, I'm not totally anti-capitalism, but we got to have some regulations. We got to have some abilities for workers to enjoy some of the fruits of their labors. You know, we got to have some discussions on how we pull the bottom up. I want the rich to get richer, but I also want the poor to get richer too. That's not happening in today's capitalism. So she's come up with inclusive capitalism, and I loved her analogy because she cited all the statistics I've pointed out on this program. The top 1/10 of 1% is getting this huge chunk, and everybody else is getting a screw job. And she goes, oh, here's what it is. You know, in the past, there was an apartment building in a neighborhood that was the envy of the neighborhood. And I love when a billionaire, when the Rothschild, is talking to me about the vision. It's an apartment building. and it's the most shiny, most beautiful. 30 years ago, it was the best, most greatest thing. It was better than sliced bread and Cheerios, and it was just fabulous. But over time, you know, it's kind of, in certain parts of the building got run down. So the top floor, you know, has a gate on it. And it's still brand new and sparkly and updated and all of that. But the middle floors are struggling a little bit, and the bottom floors are underwater. And her savior here, her way of how her system changes, we just have to fix the elevator. Without going into what the elevator is and how to fix it, we just have to fix the elevator. That's all. We call the elevator repairman. He comes in with a screwdriver and fixes it, evidently, in the inclusive capitalism world. So I look at this. And I say, okay, well, let me use her frame. The building. And she's right. The very tippy top, the roof of the building with its helicopter landing pad, because that's how they get up there, so they don't have to see us or the rabble. Is broken for the rest of us. I mean, we've never really broken through that. I mean, I look at her, and the amazing thing is her, and I read this on Wikipedia, and I actually went and checked it out. It's actually factual. Her marriage to the Rothschild just blew my mind. She evidently was introduced by Henry Kissinger at a Bilderberg Group conference in Scotland. That would send Alec Jones completely off the deep end, the Bilderbergs, but that's a whole nother. But here you go. You want to talk about the epitome of the upper, upper, upper wealth class? Not the guy just making a couple of bucks, but I'm talking the old money. People who are wealthy. And I love the analogy of, you know, Shaquille O'Neal's rich, but the guy who signs his paycheck, that guy's wealthy. These people are they're beyond that. This is generational wealth. We're 15 generations down the road. They're still going to be wealthy. And here she is telling me about, oh, we need to have inclusive capitalism. Inclusive. We're going to include everyone. And I'll tell you how we do that. We do that by taxing the hell out of someone like her. Like we did in the past, how we built the middle class of the past, and we do it on a global scale. My fear is we can do nothing until we have the next Bretton Woods. We can do nothing until the world, for lack of a better term, divvied up again, to where we start putting up borders again, to where we start saying, hey, you know, billionaire class, you can't go jumping around. We're not going to let you take your money all over wherever you want to go. Sorry, we've got to have some stability. There's got to be some control. Because what's going on right now is we're not just pitting state against state. We're pitting nation against nation. War, nothing. It's economic. And the thing last week with the actor from France, Gerard Depardieu, now a Russian citizen, I guess, because he didn't want to pay taxes. So I wonder how many of our good American global citizens will find refuge in Russia now. We're being ripped off, folks. And all of the dog and pony show that just went on is just that. It's a dog and pony show. It's a distraction. We're getting screwed. Quick break. Back with hour two of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Barely a week into the new year and economic policies loom large. The
federal CIO says with 155,000 new jobs added in December, America still needs new policies to really make a dent in long-term unemployment. Austerity, the Labor Federation says, is a foolish path because austerity kills economic recoveries. The AFL-CIO has joined with LaRassa, SEIU, the Center for Community Change, the Economic Policy Institute, the Leadership Conference, and other groups to advocate for prosperity economics. As the President and Congress confront the national debt, tax policies, and other fiscal issues, the groups have issued a report laying out an alternative to austerity economics. The central conclusion of the report is that there is no inevitable trade-off between creating a strong, dynamic economy and fostering a society marked by greater health, broader security, increased equality of opportunity, and more broadly distributed growth. The report says when government plays a more active role in the economy through investments in education and science, economies are more dynamic and innovative. The report, called Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, says we can afford to build America's productive capacity, reconnect earnings and economic security to overall productivity, and preserve a strong social safety net while building a robust economy. The report recommends major infrastructure investments in guaranteeing all qualified students the chance for a college education. The report also calls for empowering workers to engage in collective bargaining so that wages rise with productivity and economic security for working people is strengthened, the opposite of austerity economics. The merger of two nurses' unions will likely lead to a new fight for Kaiser workers in California. Jesse Russell reports.
The California Nurses Association has forged an alliance with the National Union of Healthcare Workers. The merger comes after the expiration of a non-competition agreement between the CNA and the Service Employees International Union. The CNA doesn't plan to renew that agreement, and likely signals a move by the new NUHWCNA to launch a new effort to convince 43,000 Kaiser Permanente workers to leave the SEIU. The NUHW lost an election against the SEIU in 2010, but in late 2012, the National Labor Relations Board found that Kaiser had violated federal labor laws by withholding raises from workers who had been fomenting a break with the SEIU in favor of the other union. A new election will take place this year. The CNA represents 85,000 healthcare workers in the state of California.
In New York City, the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1181, is working to avert a possible school bus strike while trying to protect jobs. Thousands of bus drivers and their supporters rallied over the weekend. The union says the city is cutting costs by bidding out jobs with private companies, and without protections in the new contract, many experienced drivers could suddenly lose their jobs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I tell you, there are days where I miss him, because Radio Gold comes out of his mouth sometime. Some of the things, educator-in-chief, and you look at what he did to education. Kind of like this report card that just came out yesterday, the first annual state policy, first annual, I love that, state policy report card. Pennsylvania got a D+. And you may go, oh, that's horrible, D+. I was hoping for an F-, to be honest with you. Put out by the people at Students First, one of these national groups funded by the billionaire class, in my opinion, destroy public education. They're on the extreme right-wing side of this. The corporate side, I shouldn't even say right-wing, the corporate side, trying to profitize, corporatize, and really take control away from you and me. Their handmaiden, Michelle Rhee, the former chancellor of the D.C. public schools, she's the head of the organization. And you got to understand, the grade was based on their ideas, their policies, the things that they want to see done. You know, like profitizing education, more high-stakes testing. Nothing about smaller classes, nothing about how do we have critical thinking children, how do we have a system, none of that stuff. How do we profitize it? And what I found very interesting is the states that, she said were, right there at the top, with the report card said were at the top, were actually at the bottom. There's this thing called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Students First, this annual report, the first one, had Louisiana at the top of its list. Yet, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, they rank 49th out of 51 in reading at the 8th grade level and 47th out of 51 in math at the 8th grade level. And that is Students First, number one rated. The best grade. Fantastic, don't you think? Here to talk about education policy, because yesterday was United Opt-Out Day, which is why I've asked Sean Johnson to come talk to us. He is a former teacher, former public school teacher, and current blogger and online radio show host of At the Chalk Face. Sean, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this report card. Pennsylvania got a D+. I got to be honest, I was hoping for an F-.
Yeah, well, you could be like the superintendent in California who said that getting the F- was a badge of honor in this case.
So in looking at, you know, I mean, what you're talking about, the opt-out, the National United Opt-Out Day, in fact, you've got a website, unitedoptout.com. Could you say that what you're doing is the opposite of what the front name, the Student First, what Michelle Rhee and those folks are trying to do?
Well, you could say that we're the exact opposite in every single way, especially since that we have absolutely no money to do anything that we're doing right now. And so we're basically just this podunk small group of educators, about six of us in different parts of the country, one of whom my close buddy and co-host Tim Slecker at Penn State Altoona. But, you know, we said that organizations like Student First, the Billionaire Boys Club, as Diane Ravitch calls it, they're not making the appropriate decisions with the use of the standardized test data. And so one of the thoughts that we had was, what if they threw a test and nobody showed up? You know, if you're not going to appropriately use the data, then we're just not going to give it to you. So that's the fundamental belief of our opt-out movement.
And what kind of response have you gotten?
Well, we've been around maybe a year and a half, and it really has grown as we've attempted to broaden and strengthen our coalitions with other grassroots organizations like Save Our Schools, Parents Across America, Change the Stakes, NY Core. And so a lot of people who really are thinking that the last quiver left in our arsenal here is, or the last arrow left in our quiver, I should say, I screwed up that metaphor, is just simply opting out of the test. Just don't take them. It seems like without the millions and billions of dollars to influence state legislatures and school boards, maybe take control of the data, if that's the coveted precious that they want so much, then we're just not going to give it to you. We're going to hold it hostage.
Because, you know, I look at this, and for me, I want my kids to have the best possible education, and I'm not hung up on these high-stakes tests. I'm more hung up on them being critical thinkers, knowing how to learn, and being able to solve problems, not just regurgitate facts and be able to, you know, basically circle in a little box.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, these standardized tests are such narrow metrics, they do none of that. They do not allow for any kinds of critical thinking or thinking outside the box or anything like that. You can just look at private schools where the wealthy students, where the affluent families send their children. They don't test these kids to death. This is the kind of education for the 99% and not the 1%.
You know, I look at this, and one of the things in your mission statement is a vision of a corporate-free public school. And I've got two small kids that are in lower grades right now, and I'm amazed at the amount of corporate sponsorship and the amount of influence that these corporations have at the lower grades, where, you know, this book report sponsored you by this, or this reading program by this, and I got to be honest, I don't want my kids constantly advertised to. I don't want them bombarded and inundated with advertising.
Well, it's partly the advertising in terms of Pearson and a lot of these other big companies that are getting into the publishing game. But what you also have here is education is a $600 billion marketplace.
Yeah.
And people want a chunk of it. And they're going to figure out ways to get themselves into the system. And so what you have is a test developed by certain people who have interest with the folks who are designing the curriculum materials that they're going to in turn sell to the schools. And then, you know, they'll grease the wheels to get their sympathetic candidates elected to local school boards or state superintendent or even governor to mandate this in the state law. So you have to use these programs. You have to use this particular test. and educators feel like they've got nothing, no other choice but to use the materials that they're required to use to prepare the students for the tests that they're required to give. And so it sort of comes full circle here.
Now, let me ask you this. I hear this frame constantly from friends, and you listen to right-wing talk radio or any of this stuff. Our schools are broken. I hear this frame all the time. Are our schools broken? Because here in the state of Pennsylvania, they say, oh, there's failing schools. Yet you look at the numbers of the some 3,200 buildings, maybe 140 of them are quote-unquote failing, depending on what matrix you're using or what standardized test, which doesn't seem like a huge number. It seems like something we could fix if those are broken. So I guess... Are our schools broken?
Well, it really is what we've got here is a solution in search of a crisis. You know, this crisis rhetoric and dialogue has been thrown out there since The Nation at Risk came out in 1983, that our school system is broken. And, you know, could you say our school system is broken? Yes, for the poorest children. That's the problem here. And really addressing poverty in terms of leveling the playing field here would cost way too much money. And so instead, we're going to impose a system of testing and metrics and grading schools, which is a cheaper way to do things. But, you know, our school system does quite well when we compare apples to apples, when we compare affluent kids to affluent children throughout the world. The biggest problem where our school system breaks down is in those under-resourced schools and communities where kids are living in devastating and crushing poverty. That's the problem, and that's a problem that's too expensive for a lot of these folks to fix.
Yeah, and there's no profit in fixing that.
Absolutely not.
You know, I grew up in the 70s, and, you know, I went to grade school in the 70s, and I remember growing up in Cleveland. The silver bullet at that time was taking poor kids from the west side of Cleveland and busing them to the east side, to a poor neighborhood on the east side, and vice versa. And we were just shuffling kids around. Resources, same broken down schools on both sides of town, both schools with lack of resources, overcrowding, all of that stuff. But we were just shuffling kids around, wasting tons of money, and it didn't really solve anything. Is this push towards privatization? Is this push towards, you know, charter schools everywhere? Is this the latest silver bullet?
Well, urban centers or at-risk or low-income communities, whatever phraseology you want to use, these are the petri dishes of education reform. And so, for example, you mentioned Louisiana as you opened the segment, as being a state that was ranked rather high on Michelle Rhee's report card. Yeah, first. You know, here's this, and one of the key criteria that Rhee's group uses is that what states are most friendly to teacher evaluation based strictly on test scores. Student growth measures, that's just a euphemism for high-stakes test scores. And so in the state of Louisiana, they have a 27-year-old young person, kid, whatever, depending on your age. I'm 34, so I don't know, younger person. That's in charge of teacher evaluation for the entire state of Louisiana. Now, this is just an absolute sham. You've got under-experienced newbies that have a certain political ideology that are in charge of teacher evaluation for the entire state. You talk about the busing. You know, all of these things, these reforms are done to the poor kids, not with, but done to them, not with their consent. You're not going to see affluent kids from the suburbs bus downtown of the city. You're going to have these kids who are, for whatever reason, from a disadvantaged background, sitting on a bus for 2 hours to go to school. And then they're going to be bused across gang territory. And then you've got further problems with that. And, you know, Secretary Arne Duncan oversaw a horrific busing program in Chicago. He's a failed urban superintendent who's now the Secretary of Education.
No, that scares me as well. You know, but you're right. You're not going to see the Obamas or Rahm Emanuel, if you're talking about Chicago, who sent their kids to the lab school out there. You're not going to see them getting involved in any of this stuff. But, you know, you look at what their kids get. And I think it's a lot of the same stuff that you folks at the opt-out movement want to talk about. Smaller class sizes, getting away from high-stakes testing and the policies that are going to label schools failures and then stealing money from them when you label them. So what are some of the other things that we should be doing to help our schools?
Well, we've got to give them the money and the resources that they need to carry out their job effectively. And we use the same language when we're talking about our military capabilities. So we say that they need the equipment the adequate resources to do their job effectively. We don't question that. You know, we give them the vehicles, the body armor, the weapon systems, the technology that they need to do their jobs effectively. But when it comes to actually resourcing the schools, then people start talking about budget cuts and deficits and things like that. So we're talking basically about money here. And then we're talking about putting the decision-making back into educators' hands and not central office administrators, definitely not mayors, and definitely not governors. You know, we need to trust teachers that they have the interests of the students in mind. They have the closest contact with the students. And then beyond that, we need to pull this free market ideology out of the school system. Schools, you know, teaching is not a customer service position. Schools aren't businesses. They're not going to run that way. So we need to give them the money to operate effectively and trust that that money is going to go to the right place. Will it always go to the right place? Not necessarily. There's going to be corruption and mismanagement and incompetence in a lot of different fields. But we need to trust that the vast majority of teachers and educators have the children's best interest at heart. We train them to do just that much, and we need to show that we have trust in them to make those decisions.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, I saw this campaign put on by ExxonMobil. Let's solve this. I don't know if you've seen these commercials.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Which are really, to me, just seem very disingenuous. Because here's a company that, you know, that isn't paying a whole lot of in the tax area where they could be funding programs to help education. But they're out there pointing out that, you know, we're internationally, we're struggling. And all their solution is, let's solve this. Not talking about how to solve it, just let's solve this.
Well, you know, and I love how the international comparisons play into this, you know, especially with the, you know, we compare ourselves to, for example, Finland. You know, Finland gets a lot of play within educational conversations because they do so remarkably well. And then when you say, well, how are they doing so well? Now, of course, their population is dramatically different. They don't have you know, millions and millions of children living in poverty. But when we start peeling away the layers of the onion and trying to see what really they're doing here that's so effective, that's when you get folks like Michelle Rhee and other education reformers say, oh, forget the international comparisons. They're perfectly willing to make these comparisons when it suits their argument. When we look at Finland, they don't do the high-stakes testing. They pay their teachers remarkably well. They treat them as professionals. They do all these things that we don't. They've got a great social welfare system. The kids aren't coming to school starving, that they're clothed, they're clean, they come from relatively safe environments, they've got child care where necessary, their parents aren't stressed out beyond belief working three jobs just to make ends meet. So, you know, the international comparisons are great, but when we look at Finland and say, well, let's compare ourselves to them and let's do absolutely that. No, forget it. Ignore them. We can't do what they're doing. It's not to scale. So the international comparisons work great when it suits the corporate argument, but it doesn't always do that. And it's really interesting to see how they'll shut those comparisons down when it runs counter to their ideology.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, they're, as you pointed out, and we've talked about this in the past, you know, what those countries are doing are the things that we should be doing, smaller class sizes, fighting poverty, longer days, all kinds of things that we should be doing, but we're not, because we seem to believe in the silver bullet.
Well, and the silver bullet is efficient, it's effective, and cost-effective, it's cheaper. You know, rather than this both-and comprehensive solutions that don't necessarily begin and end at the schoolhouse door or in the classroom. You know, these are larger-scale community initiatives, state initiatives, you know, initiatives that require government intervention. But the silver bullet is something where we can focus all of our resources most effectively, and it's the cheapest solution. And unfortunately, in a situation as complicated as education, something as complicated as child development and working with young people, it's not going to be cheap, and it's not going to be clean, and it's not going to be the single silver bullet situation. So that's the problem. And it's not going to be quantifiable either. And that's the thing about United Opt Out. It's not just about the numbers all the time. But unfortunately, you've got policymakers and wonks and legislators who just want to look from afar, look at their dashboard. Okay, how many miles have we driven? What's our speed? What's our RPM? Are we doing well? Great, fantastic. Is the check engine light on? If not, okay, great, so we're doing well. That's the best way, that's the the easiest thing they can wrap their heads around. Just a couple of PEP scores and simple quantitative metrics rather than trusting teachers with the complicated qualitative sort of things that go with teaching and learning.
Yeah, I got to be honest. My daughter the other day said she wanted to be a teacher, and I kind of cringed because I got to be honest. I look at the assaults. I look at the the direction, because I see education turning into one of the like assembly line work, because you've got people who believe that education is just that. These kids, these things called children, are empty vessels that teachers have to fill their head with all this information that they can regurgitate on command, and if they don't, well, they're failures. I got a serious problem with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one quick example. You have an affluent private school within my metro area in the state of Maryland. Private schools are not required, or their teachers at least, who teach for them, are not required to adhere to certain No Child Left Behind-oriented guidelines in terms of their qualifications and their background and experience. Private schools aren't required to do that, okay? But despite not being required to do that, they hire teachers that in most cases have master's degrees, in some cases have PhDs and extensive knowledge and experience within education, but they're not required to do that. Yet in the inner cities, it seems perfectly appropriate in some of the most challenging environments to have temporary contractors or Teach for America Corps members to go in there with no educational background whatsoever. Not a single course on education, but a five-week summer workshop. It seems like it's perfectly appropriate to send a 22-year-old into these tough environments to crank out their two-year commitment before they go to law school. It is absolutely maddening. You look at the affluent schools, what their parents and what their communities demand at $21,000 a year. They demand small class sizes. They demand art, music, PE, athletic programs. They demand teachers that are highly qualified, that have graduate degrees. They demand all of these things, yet for some reason this is not good enough for the inner city kids. The inner city kids need scripted curriculum. They need max amount of testing and test preparation. They need no excuses programs. And they need poorly trained short-term contractors that turnover rate every 2 years are going to get someone new. It's ridiculous.
It's maddening, which is why I keep saying that education is the hill that the working class of this country has to die on, and we need to be fighting every day to keep public education and to make it better going forward. UnitedOptOut.com, the website. Sean Johnson, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Hey, no problem. Anytime.
All right. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
America for the better.
Finally, in the 11th hour and 59th minute, Republicans and Democrats negotiated a fiscal reform package, which they touted as the American Taxpayer Relief Act. But if you had been allowed to peek behind the curtain during the deal-making, you would have noticed that the Dems and Repubs were not alone, and some taxpayers were getting extra special relief. Captain Morgan, Bacardi, and other Caribbean rum peddlers, for example, were at the table, picking up a $500 million liquor subsidy. NASCAR wheeled in to win a multi-million-dollar loophole for building racetracks. Railroad conglomerates hauled off a $165 million bundle for maintaining their own tracks. Disney and other fabulously wealthy Hollywood studios reeled in a $75 million subsidy for making movies. And Big Coal mined the negotiation for a federal giveaway to buy safety equipment and provide safety training for their workers. But the big dogs in the room, as usual, were Wall Street hucksters. Tucked inside the reform bill is Section 322, opaquely titled Extension of Subpart F Exception for Active Financing Income. In plain English, that line of gobbledygook will move $9 billion this year from our public treasury into the already overflowing coffers of Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other fiefdoms of high finance. Worse than the giveaway, however, is the provision's purpose. As explained by the excellent watchdog group Citizens for Tax Justice, Section 322 essentially underwrites the financing of corporate offshoring, a $9 billion subsidy for moving more U.S. jobs to foreign countries. This is Jim Hightower saying, Italians have a useful phrase that applies here. Qui bono? Who benefits? Yes, this Republican-Democrat compromise has some good provisions, but deep inside, it's the same old corporate ugliness. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
In the end, Wall Street, with Obama, Duncan, Bloomberg, Walcott, and Goldstein as its agent, they want to turn public education into private, profitable businesses. They hope to impose factory regime of managerial control over educators' working conditions and our students, our children's learning conditions.
Yeah, I got to remember when I was a kid, you know, I still remember this to this day, when the busing first started when I was a kid in Cleveland. I remember everybody on both sides, on the west side, on the east side, because we knew, instinctively, we knew there's nothing good here. This was just shuffling poor people around. And as I've said a number of times, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. Our housing project was just as bad as the housing project on the east side. You had the same levels of poverty. You had the same societal problems. You had the same composition of people. It was the same thing. The local school was in as bad a disrepair on the east side as it was on the west side because you didn't have the resources. And then they come in and say, we've got the solution. We're going to bus kids around. Going to ship them from one side of town to the other. And all we were doing was shuffling poor people around. And they did it in the name of, well, we need to have the right mix of whites and blacks. And desegregation was the idea. Well, we're gonna desegregate this. Because in the poor areas, the idea was that, well, you know, the resources were different. And they weren't. So when you went from the west side, poor kids in the west side, went to the poor kids side of town on the east side, it was the same environment. You had the same poverty, the same problems, same gang violence, all that. Only now, what you didn't have is you didn't have a tie to the community. And as I look at this whole charter school thing, and look, the corporatists figured it out. They've done a much better job of marketing. They do a much better job of selling this stuff now that the charter schools, that's the latest, greatest thing. And I look at it and they come up with nice names for students first. Like they actually give a rat's behind about students. And you look at their first annual report that puts Louisiana at the very top of their list. They're the best state right there, Louisiana. Even though 49th out of 51 in 8th grade reading scores, 47th out of 51 in math scores. And you go to Florida, who they took second. Florida, second best. Because it's ideology. It has nothing to do with actual, results. I mean, even the testing data that they use, not working. Florida's 35th in reading, 42nd in math. Indiana, they got third. 30th in reading, 23rd in math. District of Columbia, where Michelle Rhee came from, and there's some question about her tenure there. According to this National Assessment of Educational Progress, District of Columbia, where their handmaiden come from, dead last, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Dead last. And then Rhode Island, fifth in on this survey, 29th in both reading and math. And you look at this and you go, well, you know, none of their top five are in the top half of states in this assessment. None of them. But again, it's not about fact. It's about ideology. It's not about reality. It's about pure blind faith belief. Quick break right back after this. Stick around.
90% of the people own 90% of the wealth. 90% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in?
their smart policy. And sound engagement matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky. We don't just live in a spiral galaxy. We live in a barred spiral galaxy.
In other words, our galaxy has a central bar-shaped structure, like a straight stick in the middle, composed of stars. But until recently, scientists didn't know which Milky Way stars are part of the bar. Now, an international team of astronomers says it has found hundreds of stars rapidly moving together in long, looping orbits around the center of our Milky Way. They think these stars are part of the Milky Way's bar.
These astronomers use data from a large survey project called Apogee, which uses a telescope in New Mexico. The data showed them the velocities of nearly 5,000 stars near the Milky Way's center, a substantial fraction of those stars were moving away from us quickly.
Then they compared these observations with computer models of the Milky Way's central bar. They concluded that the stars they were measuring, those fleeing from Earth, are part of the bar. They said that these stars are in the part of the bar rotating away from our direction in space.
But that's just one side of the bar of the Milky Way center. On the other side of the bar, the stars must be moving toward Earth. The other half of the Milky Way central bar is visible only from Earth's southern hemisphere. That's why these astronomers plan to use a telescope in Chile to observe the rest of the inner Milky Way, beginning in 2014. We have more at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Neither of these things absolves us from blame. So speaking for the senior management team and myself, while we can't assure you we won't make mistakes, we can assure you we're going to try not to. These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We were accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company. This is not how we want to run a business.
That's not how we want to run our business. No, no. Well, we've got the government to bail us out. You got to love Jamie Dimon. Sorry, we won't do it again. Promise. Wow. Another settlement down the drain. Another one that doesn't come close to fixing our problems or making just restitution in my mind. And of course, puts no one in jail. And sounds really big. I mean, they came up with an $8.5 billion number, which, you know, amazes me. Our media doesn't bother to ask how much the haul was. Just reported a big, shiny number. Yay, $8.5 billion. Have we not seen this movie time and time again? Isn't it getting a little tiresome? So 10 banks settled for $8.5 billion and screwed, well, countless number of homeowners. Again, I keep asking the question, how much did they get away with? They settled for $8.5 billion. How much did it cost us? Which is why I've asked Kevin Whalen, National Campaign Director at the National Home Defenders League, homedefendersleague.org, the website. Come talk to us about this settlement. Kevin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rick.
So I look at this, $8.5 billion sounds like a big, big number. Wow, big, huge number. They really got what was coming to them, right?
I don't think there's anybody, maybe except some bankers, who are arguing that this amount of money is what the bankers had coming to them or is in any way in proportion to what they stole when they crashed the economy, costing, you know, countless millions of people their jobs and their livelihoods, plus the ongoing foreclosure crisis that's, you know, by no means done, moving millions of families out of their homes.
Bankers crashed the economy? I thought it was those poor people who those poor people who government made those banks give loans to.
You know, that is one of the big lies that people are know enough to be angry at the banks. I'm not sure that enough people have pointed out the extent to which that is a lie. That, you know, hardworking people, nobody's immune to the economic to losing their job in an economic crisis. But it wasn't you know, us working stiffs that crashed the economy or sliced or diced mortgages or sent sold them 100 ways. So there's still somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion in lost equity or debt overhang, they call it in business terms, but money that banks are trying to collect on people's houses that aren't even worth that. And that's, in addition to all the bailouts and everything, part of the haul that the banks got away with.
Yeah, and they keep getting away with it. I mean, you know, you keep hearing the frames that it was the poor people or those public sector workers or those teachers or the cops or firefighters, all those people who wanted health care and pensions and all that. They're the ones who crashed the economy, not these thieves on Wall Street. And I look at this, $8.5 billion sounds like a big number. What's it mean to the average homeowner who got screwed in this, if they're even eligible to get anything out of it?
Well, here's a little bit of good news, which is that this $8.5 billion in particular replaces an earlier version, an earlier thing that was going to sort of on track to get people exactly $0. So I don't want to compare it to justice, to what needs to happen to hold the bankers criminally accountable, or the amount of money we need to fight for to win to even begin to make this right. But it does, this settlement replaces something that was called the Independent Foreclosure Review, which was one of the first things the government and this obscure office called the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which has traditionally been the most useless of various agencies that were supposed to regulate the banks. And they began this at the after robo-signing and other scandals about the banks not following their own rules or laws that they had largely written about doing the paperwork on foreclosures came to light. And it had been going on for years, and it was sort of a scam from the beginning. Banks were hiring their own consultants or their own employees to review each loan and see if they could find any problem. It later came out they were paying about $12,000 per review or paying consultants up to $630 an hour and didn't seem to be finding any problems. It all looked fine to them as far as we could tell. While people under that process were supposed to be eligible for up to $125,000 if they were wrongly foreclosed on or some lesser amount, maybe $5,000 or other amounts for other problems. It was a process that had been going on forever, and they didn't even manage to get notices out or applications back to very many people. The first deadline to apply actually came and went before they came up with an application form, and they had to extend it. So in that sense, people raising hell about that, and the continuing protests, large and small, one person at a time or by large community groups demanding some kind of justice for this, helped get them to the point where they were wanted to do something else. And $8.5 billion is a drop in the bucket compared to what banks stole. But it does look like some, $3 billion or so of that is supposed to go to homeowners who have been foreclosed on and some other amounts for principal reduction. So that leaves lots of questions about who will get it, what communities will get it, if it was the folks who are hurt worst that will, that are unanswered. But you do want to, we wouldn't have gotten that much if people hadn't stood up and
and
fought
back
for their homes and fought for their communities.
Right. My question was, and I saw the number is, you know, the article I read said that people who got foreclosed on wrongfully would be compensated from hundreds of dollars up to, as you said, $125,000. And my first thought was, well, what if you lost $200,000? What if your home is worth $200,000? Are you just out the rest of it? The bank ends up keeping it?
If you got foreclosed on, that could certainly be the case, and there's no details that we've really seen yet on how they're going to figure out, since they stopped this review process that didn't make a lot of sense. There's no rhyme or reason to it anyway, but how they'll figure out who's eligible for the $115,000 or who's eligible for a lower amount. So there's a lot of questions about how that's going to get figured out and if that process is going to be fair or not. Clearly, you divide up everybody that got foreclosed on and the amount of money, and it's not very much per person. And there's a lot of ways that the banks, admitted, and it's come clear that they sort of cheated on all the paperwork all the time, all across the country. So exactly how much that hurt each person, it'd be complicated if you were trying to honestly determine it, and so far it's been up to the banks to figure it out or people they hired to figure it out, and that doesn't give folks a lot of confidence.
No, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence. I mean, I look at, $25 billion settlement that they had just a couple of months ago that we end up finding out a lot of the states just used for, their general budgets. I look at Wisconsin, and you go, the homeowner getting screwed again.
Well, that's right, and there are, that settlement was, again, pennies on the dollar for the amount of damage that banks caused and are still causing to communities with unnecessary foreclosures. And then as details have rolled out about how banks have done that, there were things in the settlement that let them get credit for helping people whose homes are underwater and writing a new mortgage that was closer to the actual value of their houses, but they also got credit for things like tearing down abandoned houses they already owned or forcing people into short sales, which is just a sort of more orderly form of foreclosures. So they're part of that $26 billion is for things that don't particularly help people in the first place or things that banks just needed to do, although some amount of it will roll into relief that lets people stay in their homes and keep paying on a mortgage that's a little closer to what the house is actually worth post-crash.
But let me ask you this, because, I look at this, and, I know a couple people who, they told me their mortgage is underwater. They're paying for something that is, worth maybe, 25% less than what they owe on it. And my first thought is, why don't you just walk away from it? At some point, just let it go. Or isn't there a way that we could, declare eminent domain, have the communities take those properties back and sell them back something?
Absolutely. And, that looking at it as an investment and whether it's rational is how big businesses and banks deal with problems like this in the first place. So including, there was a wonderful John Stewart segment about it, the headquarters for the Mortgage Bankers Association wasn't worth what they paid to build it. And, they called up and renegotiated with their lender and came up with something that was more realistic. And that's what a bank does if they've got a skyscraper that's underwater on its mortgage. Working class people and people who've worked hard for their homes, one, want to stay in the home that they're raising their family in, and two, are bullied and shamed as if they should pay for some moral obligation to these banks that ruin the economy. So through these settlements, as inadequate as they are, has forced the banks to, in some cases, lower people's mortgages to be more like what the real post-crash value is. Sometimes banks will do it because people yell at them, because people campaign bravely in their communities and fail to leave. Sometimes they'll even do it because it's actually the better business decision, right? To come to some agreement with the person living there and, rather than sell the home, take the home and sell it, post foreclosure for a lot less money. And some communities are, in fact, looking at using eminent domain, in order to, not take the house from the person living in it, but take the mortgage that's overvalued and resell it to somebody else so that people can pay on a mortgage that's worth more like the actual value of their home. So there's been some discussion of that in California, and The city of Brockton actually voted last night to study this proposal and set up a working group to look into it.
Good.
There's
I think
a lot of action all over the country.
I mean, because at the end of the day, here we are. We're 4 years into this collapse. And still, I don't think enough has been done to solve this, because I don't think the nation turns around until we put this housing crisis, this behind us, this whole debacle, until we fix it, hold people accountable, and get people out from underwater.
Well, Rick, if you're listening to the bankers, it's time to let bygones be bygones and, you know, forget about this whole mess.
No. But, I haven't seen the perp walks yet. I want people going to prison.
But for the rest of us, there are people all across the country and across, you know, wide political stripes that want to see somebody locked up. You know, if I rob a bank, I get put in jail. But if a bank robs the entire economy, doesn't anybody get arrested? And then, one reason that we believe, besides the bravery of people who occupy homes or community groups that stand up and fight this, is that it's also true that the economy can't get unstuck until something is done about this. And so across anybody from people who want to have a job to work at to even people that run businesses and want to have people to sell to, there is a recognition that they can't keep screwing around like they have been, losing everybody's paperwork, giving people to run around and on a slow track to foreclosure that's going to dislocate, you know, additional several million, 5, 8, 10 million people from their homes in a great waste of value and disruption to families and communities. But that turning this around somehow is one of the few ways you really could see money going back into the economy in a way that would fix it. And that's one of the things that gives us hope that it's worth it for people to keep up the fight in ways large and small.
Yeah, you know, I look at all these settlements, and I'm still not seeing people held accountable. I'm seeing, you know, I just saw another one. Bank of America settled with Fannie Mae for something like $10 billion. And you go, you know, if they're settling for $10 billion, how much did they walk away from? How much did they walk away with? And how much is it going to end up costing me and people like me in the long run? Because we're the ones ultimately who end up shouldering this burden.
Well, and it raises the question in that settlement between Fannie Mae and Bank of America. So if they've sorted it out at the end of the day, they did the math and realized that the loans and weren't worth what they said they were and worked it out between themselves. Do the people living in the houses and paying those loans also now get to pay on a loan that's at that lower value? If Fannie Mae and B of A both agree it's only worth X amount, does that mean they settle it up between themselves, but I still have to pay the 25% or 50% or whatever else it's overvalued at? It seems like if I'm paying, and as a taxpayer paying for Fannie Mae, then, you know, my loan should reflect the value that they've both admitted is what it's really worth at the end of the day. And in fact, that's what needs to happen to have some measure of financial justice and get the economy moving again, because it doesn't make sense for people either to be dislocated from their homes for no reason, or for people to pay perpetually on value that was never really there, although banks have collected their profits on it.
Last thought I wanted to get from you. You know, I look at I don't know if you saw this story about AIG, because I've been seeing these ads on TV about saying, oh, we paid back all of the money with interest because, you know, thank you. We told you we were going to do it, and thank you. We paid back all the money. And now I see a story that they want to sue the government because, well, the terms were bad.
I did just see that, and I like everybody, I think I saw those ads on TV and the newspaper and kind of thought, huh, I wonder what that's about. You know, it's something a little different. And, you know, what could be their motivation there? Yeah, and then you turn around and it turns out that was all a prelude to suing the government for bailing them out, restoring them to tens of millions in profit, but they're going to sue them for not bailing them out enough, apparently.
That's like you saving me from drowning and me suing you for getting my suit wet.
That's right.
It's nuts.
You know, there's clearly a small group of people that don't have any sense of shame. I don't know if they took the ads out to rub it in a little bit or exactly what the motivation was. You know, it's stuff like that still leaves people, even though it's 4 or 5 years into the crisis, besides the fact that our lives and communities are still being affected, that leaves people mad. And there's still, you know, millions of people out there that are mad enough to fight about this.
Man, I'm one of them. Kevin Whalen, I appreciate the time. National Campaign Director at the Home Defenders League, homedefendersleague.org. If you've got questions, any ideas, thoughts. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
Well, you know, I sit and I think about this stuff. You remember the other day we talked about Gerald Nadler, the Democrat from New York, who came up with the idea that, well, you know, what we'll do is we'll make a trillion-dollar coin. And we're going to make the trillion-dollar coin, and we're going to just put it into the Treasury, and we're going to pay off our debts. Because if the Republicans are going to hold the country hostage, we're going to do something ridiculous like they're willing to do. Because evidently there's a law from the 90s sometime, that gave the Treasury Department the right to print coins made out of a little bit of platinum and put whatever denomination they wanted on it. I guess, you know, as I understand it, the law was written for commemorative coins or something. But evidently some say it can be used, we can make a $1 trillion coin. Well, you've got the Republican Greg Walden from Oregon who is saying, well, you propose something stupid, I'm going to come up with legislation to stop something stupid. And they're going to try and pass a law saying Treasury can't mint $1 trillion coin. Not that the Treasury has shown any interest whatsoever. Not that there's any been any serious talk about it. But we're gonna show you. I've got a compromise. You want to be preposterous? You want to be outrageous? I say we print the $1 trillion coin and we put Ronald Reagan's face on it. Because consider this for a second. You look at the national debt of this country. You know, we were kind of moving right along the midline there. We had some periods of high debt. Had less than $1 trillion of debt before Reagan took over. And then boom, Reagan, our debt tripled during his time in office. Not to mention the debt tripling robbed the Social Security money blind. Largest tax increase in history with the Social Security check your paycheck still going on to this day. Because they were robbing it blind. Robbed it blind. So I look at this and I go, you know, hey, why not? I mean, what's going to happen come the middle of February when the Republicans who want government shutdown, who want the 90s part two, they want their do-over. What's going to happen? I mean, are they going to allow the government to shut down? Because I've heard a lot of Republicans saying, yes, we don't want it to happen. You know, it'll be disruptive, but we think it should. Scary stuff, man. I mean, these are people who, if they don't get their way, like two-year-olds, petulant children, fingers in the ears, kicking and screaming, mine, my way. It's nuts. Got an email during the break that points out, you know, hey, I was talking about Michelle Rhee's grading system, and he said, you know, you're talking about her system. What's more frightening than her grading system is the amount of weight our policymakers in Harrisburg give the grade and anything she says. And I got to be honest, it scares me too. And the reason that they give her so much weight, the reason she gets so much credit and so much juice is the billionaires who are backing her. It's about the money. And I look at this survey done at the World Economic Forum. They surveyed, you know, government officials, academics, industry official people from around the world. And they've come up with, you know, a couple of things. You know, what's going to be the big global risk of the future? And they've said income inequality. One of the big, right at the very top. Right up there with fiscal imbalances, greenhouse gas emissions, and water. They're saying, well, you know, it could happen. You know, we could have a major systematic failure across the globe. And I look at what's going on in Wall Street. I look at what we're allowing the banksters to get away with. And I'm telling you, folks, it's coming again. I mean, this whole bailout thing with AIG, can you believe that they're actually thinking about suing you and me? Because, well, you know what? We made them pay the money back with interest. The shareholders of AIG, not happy. So they're going to sue. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Also, smartphone, Stitcher. Take the podcast with you on the go. Going to take a quick break. Back with hour three right after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Barely a week into the new year and economic policies loom large. The AFL-CIO says with 155,000 new jobs added in December, America still needs new policies to really make a dent in long-term unemployment. Austerity, the Labor Federation says, is a foolish path because austerity kills economic recoveries. The AFL-CIO is joined with LaRassa, SEIU, the Center for Community Change, the Economic Policy Institute, the Leadership Conference, and other groups to advocate for prosperity economics. As the President and Congress confront the national debt, tax policies, and other fiscal issues, the groups have issued a report laying out an alternative to austerity economics. The central conclusion of the report is that there is no inevitable trade-off between creating a strong, dynamic economy and fostering a society marked by greater health, broader security, increased equality of opportunity, and more broadly distributed growth. The report says when government plays a more active role in the economy through investments in education and science, economies are more dynamic and innovative. The report, called Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, says we can afford to build America's productive capacity, reconnect earnings and economic security to overall productivity, and preserve a strong social safety net while building a robust economy. The report recommends major infrastructure investments in guaranteeing all qualified students the chance for a college education. The report also calls for empowering workers to engage in collective bargaining so that wages rise with productivity and economic security for working people is strengthened, the opposite of austerity economics. The merger of two nurses' unions will likely lead to a new fight for Kaiser workers in California. Jesse Russell reports.
The California Nurses Association has forged an alliance with the National Union of Healthcare Workers. The merger comes after the expiration of a non-competition agreement between the CNA and the Service Employees International Union. The CNA doesn't plan to renew that agreement and likely signals a move by the new NUHWCNA to launch a new effort to convince 43,000 Kaiser Permanente workers to leave the SEIU. The NUHW lost an election against the SEIU in 2010, but in late 2012, the National Labor Relations Board found that Kaiser had violated federal labor laws by withholding raises from workers who had been fomenting a break with the SEIU in favor of the other union. A new election will take place this year. The CNA represents 85,000 healthcare workers in the state of California.
In New York City, the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1181, is working to avert a possible school bus strike while trying to protect jobs. Thousands of bus drivers and their supporters rallied over the weekend. The union says the city is cutting costs by bidding out jobs with private companies, and without protections in the new contract, many experienced drivers could suddenly lose their jobs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So as somebody who is dead set against the concept of corporations being people because they're not living, breathing, they don't die, they live forever. I mean, you look at some of the stories I've seen, 200-year loans for corporations. Obviously, we're not putting them in jail. And look, for free speech for corporations, yay, you and me, not so much. So I found it interesting when I came across a story of a guy who decided that, you know what, I'm going to take on this idea of corporate personhood, and I'm going to get my corporation in the passenger seat, and we're going to go driving in the high occupancy lane, the carpool lane. Got pulled over, taken it to court yesterday. We're going to find out what the outcome of that was. I've got Jonathan Friedman on the line, taxpayer, driver, if you will. Let's going to talk about the big case. Jonathan, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm here in San Rafael.
I appreciate the time. You know, I look at this, and, you know, I've been saying, you know, what are we going to do with this whole concept of corporate personhood? You've got an interesting angle on this. I got one sitting in the passenger seat with you.
Right. In the government codes of the state, and also probably in the county codes, and maybe even in Pennsylvania, but here. We have persons are defined as human beings and as corporations, and it's a fluid definition. And in the what we have here are called carpool lanes, the high occupancy vehicle lanes, during restricted hours, which are usually the rush hour.
Right.
You need to have two persons. That's what the sign says on the side of the road. You need two persons in the car in order to be in that lane during that time. So when I saw that about 10 years ago, I thought, I wonder if they do have that definition as a corporation and as a person, and they did. And I thought, well, I'm going to see if I can test this. And every once in a while, I would get into the carpool lane with incorporation papers from a family foundation and drive up and down the road and see if I can get nabbed. And it finally happened in October.
I said, you know, I look at this. You're not against the I guess the first question, are you against the high occupancy lanes on the highway?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Okay.
I think they're a good idea. There's some discussions whether they actually work, but I'm not really too concerned about that.
So it's strictly the idea of the your passenger. You don't either you. So do you believe that your passenger is a person, and should you get off?
Well, the corporation is a person under the law, and so I wanted the court to say, yes, you can do this. But when you, if you think about it, that means everybody could get a corporation and get their incorporation papers and ride with them in the car and alone during restricted hours. In the carpool lane. So the court said no because they didn't want to do that, and they thought that the original meaning of the law is, or intent, I should say, was all about trying to get people into, multiple people into cars in the high occupancy vehicle lane. And so that's why they said no. But when they did that, they locked themselves into saying that corporations are not persons in the high occupancy vehicle lane. And that kind of discrimination against corporations, I don't think they want. And they're also saying that corporations aren't persons. So we're going to appeal.
Absolutely.
To see what they see what they actually mean.
Yeah, I mean, because the ruling that came out of the Marin County traffic hearing yesterday, I understand, no. So now you're going to take it to the appeals court and say, hey, now they've said that corporations aren't people. The law says they are. That's an interesting defense.
Right, right. You know, so it's ironic. It's ironic, you know. I mean, I don't like the ruling that corporations can be persons, and yet I am asking the court in the state to say, yes, I want corporations to be persons. It's an ironic twist, and we'll see what they do at the appellate level.
Well, I mean, the hope then becomes we can have that conversation of do we really want to have cars full of corporations driving down the streets, maybe not even with a driver.
Right, right. But, you know, the one thing that it does throw open is the question of exactly what signifies a corporation. Corporations are fictitious entities, and they've been around for 400 or 500 years or so, and 200 years ago in the U.S., then they were very weak. They could only live for a certain while. They weren't persons under the law. They could only do work in the state in which they were incorporated. For example, in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Railroad, for example, is one of the original corporations that pushed to get to be allowed to work in other states. And so, they gained all these rights and strength over the years, and one of the toppers was to have personhood in order to not be discriminated against. But what they did it was through the use of the 14th Amendment, which was originally for the freed African-American slaves.
Right. So then the question becomes, was that the intent of that law then? Was that the intent? I mean, if you're using the intent of the law of this traffic court and saying that wasn't the intent of the law, was that the intent of the amendment to give corporations the same rights as people?
It was, I think, abused by corporations to do that. And what they did was they did a lot of work in the courts in order to get all these rights as persons and to not be discriminated against. So you have a judge, though, saying that sometimes a corporation is a person and sometimes they're not. And we can't have them do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a weird position. Either they are or they're not. Either we hold them accountable, lock them up, throw them in jail, kill them, whatever, or we can't. One or the other.
Exactly.
So what kind of response are you getting from people across the country? I've got to imagine that you're getting a very positive response from some.
The outpouring of support from people whom I don't know. I'm getting emails from folks I don't know, phone calls. I think the number of people who follow me on Twitter has gone up like 70%. It's been great. It's just been wonderful. If you look at where the story appears, though, online, some of the comments aren't too happy, but nobody's directly said that to my face. But I've gotten a lot of support from all the media and from a number of the lawyers and law professors with whom I have worked over the years on this issue. And so that's very gratifying as well.
Because at the end of the day, I firmly believe we cannot have a democratic system in this country until we get the money out and we get all of the secret money and the dark money out of our politics and we get back to a reasonable amount of money in this system. Because to me, it's the money that's destroying our system.
Oh, that's very true. And you know, I've been asked why is personhood so bad. Well, it's literally a cloak. It's like the skin on top of the bones of a massive legal system that is very hard to address. And for that reason, because corporations are so difficult to address and so difficult to prosecute. And as you pointed out, they don't go to jail. They live forever. They can amass lots and lots of money in their banks and their treasuries and so on. And they can, as we have seen, really pervert our political system through all the expenses and the campaign funds that they do. You're exactly right.
You know, I think back to my grandfather who passed away several years back, and he said, you've got rights in this country, but you need money to make sure that all of your rights are guaranteed. And I look at these corporations who, as you pointed out, can amass huge amounts of wealth and can live on infinitum and be able to drag things, and their rights would be sacrosanct as were ours. Well, that's negotiable. And I look at what's going on with these banks and how we're settling with these banks, because government even knows. Hey, we can't draw this out forever. They've got the upper hand.
Exactly. And some time ago, I read that after the bailout, that most of the money that had gone to the banks was still sitting in their treasuries and hadn't been lent out. And that's part of the reason why our economic recovery has not been as nearly as complete as it could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Now you look at the story that AIG is considering suing the U.S. government for bailing it out.
Right. Wow. Wow. Right.
It's just maddening. And to say that these corporations, who are really a construct of we the people, something that was supposed to be used to benefit us, not to control us, are kind of completely flipped around, I think, on us.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's very true.
You know, as this goes on, I'd love to have you back and keep us updated. Where do you see this going? What's the time frame of the next step, Jonathan?
Well, we have 30 days to appeal, and we worked so hard on getting just through yesterday that I forget exactly to whom we appeal. I don't know whether it's to the Superior Court, because this is a traffic case, either that or the appellate court. I'm not too sure which. And that's we file within 30 days, and after that, I don't know how long that takes. I know that one case I was involved in about a year ago, the appellate process takes close to a year. But I'm glad you want to have us back on this. We will. We've got the contact through Steve Berto, I believe, our PR guy.
Right.
And we really would love to have the support of your listenership as we go through this process.
Yeah.
Tell me, are you? What part of Pennsylvania are you in?
We're in the central part. We're in the Harrisburg area. We're in the central part of the state.
Oh, then you probably would know Tom Lindsay then.
Not offhand.
I would check him out in your area, because he does a tremendous amount of work, corporations and communities trying to gain sovereignty.
Okay, we'll most certainly do that. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you. How are you funding this? Are you getting donations from people? Do you have the ability for folks to send you a couple of bucks in the event that you need to take this on a prolonged legal battle?
That's a good question. Right now, I'm the guy who's funding it. I have some independent income, and so it's enough to live quite well and give some money away. And also, I've got a law degree, and so I've been a community advocate for quite some time. And this is just one of the several projects with which I'm involved. So it's me alone, and we were just discussing it today, the lawyer and I and Ford Green, and we thought, we probably have to make this somewhat of an institution in order to be able to raise some funds, and we'll let you know.
I appreciate it, because we'd love to have you back as this moves on, because I think it's a good idea, and I think it's highlighting the fact that really, honestly and truthfully, they're not people. Corporations are not people. You and me, flesh and blood living people, we're people. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com. Finally, in the 11th hour and 59th minute, Republicans and Democrats negotiated a fiscal reform package, which they touted as the American Taxpayer Relief Act. But if you had been allowed to peek behind the curtain during the deal-making, you would have noticed that the Dems and Repubs were not alone, and some taxpayers were getting extra special relief. Captain Morgan, Bacardi, and other Caribbean rum peddlers, for example, were at the table, picking up a $500 million liquor subsidy. NASCAR wheeled in to win a multi-$1 million loophole for building racetracks. Railroad conglomerates hauled off a $165 million bundle for maintaining their own tracks. Disney and other fabulously wealthy Hollywood studios reeled in a $75 million subsidy for making movies. And Big Coal mined the negotiation for a federal giveaway to buy safety equipment and provide safety training for their workers. But the big dogs in the room, as usual, were Wall Street hucksters. Tucked inside the reform bill is Section 322, opaquely titled extension of subpart F exception for active financing income. In plain English, that line of gobbledygook will move $9 billion this year from our public treasury into the already overflowing coffers of Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other fiefdoms of high finance. Worse than the giveaway, however, is the provision's purpose. As explained by the excellent watchdog group Citizens for Tax Justice, Section 322 essentially underwrites the financing of corporate offshoring, a $9 billion subsidy for moving more U.S. jobs to foreign countries. This is Jim Hightower saying, Italians have a useful phrase that applies here. Qui bono? Who benefits? Yes, this Republican-Democrat compromise has some good provisions, but deep inside, it's the same old corporate ugliness. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons. Lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Or at least God Incorporated. Yeah, you know, I've often thought about that. You know, maybe we should all just be corporations. No more people. No flesh and blood. We're all corporations. You know, here on the program, you know, the program's a corporation. Maybe I'm the program, the corporation. Rick Smith, LLC. Put it on my driver's license. You think they'd let me do that? Probably not. But I looked down in Texas, found it kind of interesting that, you know, one of the state reps down in Texas, they have filed a bill that is going to require, you know, people who work in, you know, strip clubs or any, you know, any of those things, they have to get a license. Basically kind of incorporating, making them corporate people, kind of get a license to be a stripper in the state of Texas. This is what they want. And, you know, I love this whole idea. You know, I've got a whole bunch of my really very conservative friends who, you know, I believe to get government out of my life, yet they would support something like this. Well, you're going to have a license to drive a car. What the hell has that got to do with this? Anyway, evidently, according to the news report, they're going to have to get a license, and there would be a whole litany of requirements to be a pole dancer. Including being at least 18 and completing a course about human trafficking. No one who would be convicted of any crimes could get a license. Nothing like obscenity or public lewdness or any of that stuff. You would not be eligible. No. The bill also states that anyone who receives a license would have to wear it while doing their job. And I thought, you know, isn't that kind of defeating the whole purpose of being a stripper? The whole idea is having nothing on. They want to put a license plate on you. And that just brings up a whole bunch of really interesting questions. And then I think about from the personhood frame. Would we make corporations do that? Maybe if people in corporations were the same, maybe you have to put an address across your belly button. Who knows? This all goes in some really bizarre places, and I've always been against the idea of corporate personhood. They're not like you or me. Sorry, not going to happen. But they have maneuvered the legal system, and as I understand it, I've read a couple of books on it. You know, it was a footnote in some obscure Supreme Court case back in the 1850s, 1860s, sometime around there. If I remember, it was like something like Santa Clara Railroad. It was a footnote. It was put in by a clerk who just happened to be, you know, a former worker, foreman of the railroads. Cozy kind of situation. But evidently that became part of the basis of all of this. A footnote. A mistake. Something that was, someone thought was part of the ruling, which was not. It was inserted by a clerk. So our entire policy towards corporations was contrived from something added by a clerk. And here we are. Corporations now have all of this power. blows the mind. Interesting story. I got emailed to me, and of course you can always email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, about Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the lunatic out there in Arizona, Maricopa County, Arizona. Evidently, according to reports, he has asked for volunteers, because what happened in Connecticut, and look, you know, my wife and I still, talk about, keeping the kids safe. And, as a caller asked earlier, how did the guy get into the school building? Our local school is, instituting new policies. But, Sheriff Joe is taking the NRA's position. We're going to put armed guards. And evidently his volunteer force of somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 people, are going to patrol. And he calls them their posse. The posse will patrol some 50 schools in the unincorporated Maricopa County area, according to CBS 5 out there in Arizona. They're going to have all their own weapons and all their own equipment. And oh, by the way, some of them have criminal backgrounds. But yeah, never mind that. Never mind that. Evidently, the volunteer patrols will kick into full gear on Wednesday. Evidently, there's going to be a big press conference. So, and I look at this and I go, this is the kind of stuff that scares me. When you start seeing these vigilantes, now we're going to have some yahoo who has a gun walking around the schoolyard. It blows my mind. And this is the kind of stuff. Listen, gun supporters, this stuff makes you guys look really, really bad. Every time there's one of these big shootings, it makes the call for gun control even greater. And Sheriff Joe's not helping anybody. Really not. And then when you see this story out of Utah, which, the people who want less government, the people who tell us, get government out of our lives, and we shouldn't have to buy health care, and we shouldn't have to do that. Here, this guy, he wants everyone to be required to have a gun in the house. So if you live in Spring City, Utah, one of the city councilmen there, he wanted to put a resolution forward that said every person in town must have a gun and take gun training courses. The rest of the council said, well, it's a little extreme. We will strongly recommend that every homeowner own a gun. Because evidently, the Spring City area there in Utah relies on a part-time police force. And, they don't have the same response times, not always all that great. So he basically wants volunteers, citizens to police, where, policemen would really regularly do that. And I find it interesting that, one of the solutions is maybe hiring a cop, if that's what you really wanted. Are more guns the answer? I'm not so sure, especially if they're walking around my kid's school with no real official reason to be there. And look, I'm not a gun control big advocate. I think there's some things that we can do. I don't want assault weapons in people's hands. I don't think you need an AK-47. I don't think you need an M16 or an M4 carbine. I don't think you need those. And I think Stanley McChrystal, the retired general, this morning said kind of the same thing. Look, you spent a career carrying one of those around. Don't think average everyday citizens need them. Soldiers should have them. People shouldn't. I look at this, and he's out promoting his book because, if you remember, he was fired from his position back in 2010 for some comments to Rolling Stone. But he's out promoting his book, and he was asked, look, what should we do on it? He said, look, some serious action needs to be done. I think a conversation has to be had. And I know you can't walk around with an M16 or an M4 now, but I get his point. And the more I look at these tragedies, and look, folks, the reality is the more of these that we have, and there will be another one, the more the call is going to be. So we should be doing some rational things while we can. And now I see Gabby Giffords, who was shot was about 2 years ago. And I can't believe it was 2 years ago. She is starting a pack. I guess everyone's going to start a pack now. Americans for Responsible Solutions is the name of the pack. And kind of to take on some of the NRA stuff. Because the NRA has become so powerful and so all-encompassing that no discussion can really happen. And they're going to raise a ton of money off of this. They have really done some great fundraising during the Obama years. I had this conversation this morning with a guy at the diner, and he said, well, Obama wants to take our guns. And I was like, well, show me where. Because I've yet to see it. Well, he wants to take our bullets. I'm going, well, show me where. I've yet to see that. There has been nothing. There's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of NRA, you know, getting people all worked up. But there's been no actual legislation or movement. And still, to this day, nothing that's going after this. There have been some conversations. Biden had a little conversation, which we should be doing. And I'm open to a bunch of ideas. What I'm not open to is having yahoos like Sheriff Joe and his posse of 3,000 walking around schools carrying guns. I just don't think that ends well. And it's a major distraction from education, don't you think? Just a thought. Let's take a quick break right back after this with Bob Ney from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back. Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the ties of mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're in looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
If one thing is certain about this year's elections, it's that working families can't afford to sit on the sidelines. The stakes couldn't be higher for American workers. This election is about how we'll move our country forward. We know that can't happen without strengthening the middle class and making sure the wealthy are paying their fair share. And it can't happen without you. Be a voter. Stand up for candidates who stand up for working families. This message brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters.
Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. David Bowie, 66 years old today. In fact, came out with a new single today. 10 years it's been, I guess, since the last bit of music. He's done something like 30 studio recordings, had just a great career. And, you know, came out with a new song. Well, let's play a little bit of it. Thoughts? Let's get the thought on it. Huh? Let's hear it.
Had to get the train.
Right.
From Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that.
Wow. Ziggy Stardust, this is definitely not. Maybe should have waited 11 years. Wow. But I guess I will bet you that song is going to be much more popular than Congress. And the folks at the public polling policy group have public policy polling group have come out with a poll on how much people hate Congress. And I would bet that people like that song a lot more than Congress. In fact, they come up with some interesting numbers. Lice, 67% of people preferred lice over Congress. 69% Brussels sprouts over Congress. 56% the replacement refs over Congress. And my favorite, a couple of favorites. A colonoscopy, 58% over Congress. Root canals, 56% over Congress. Wow. Let's find out what's going on in D.C. and around the world. They've got Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. So what do you think? The Bowie song, good, bad, and different?
Horrible. I go back to now the first one you played, Rebel Rebel, and that goes back to Karl Rove when I knew him and he had long hair and a size 26 waist.
Wow,
yeah.
And you know, my producer, who's a bit younger than both of us, said, "Well, what did he ever do?" And I said, "Well, I guess if one thing you could give David Bowie credit for, he brought androgyny into the mainstream."
Yes. How old is your producer?
26.
Oh, I have underwear older than that. Okay. My goodness.
But you know, the Ziggy Stardust years were fantastic. That.
Yeah, I like that song better.
Yeah, I mean that's just horrible. So what do you think? Colonoscopy over Congress? Where do you fall? Colonoscopy,
yeah,
Congress?
Yeah, I'm in the colonoscopy or that song over Congress, sure.
Congress.
I'm for Ohio winter over that.
Wow.
Congress.
That's something. Having grown up in Cleveland, up there on the North Shore.
I know you did. That's right.
I think I'm going to take Congress. That's at least entertaining. But Congress did beat out North Korea, Lindsay Lohan, the Ebola virus, gonorrhea, and the Kardashians.
And Osama bin Laden, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think he's dead. They took him off the
list.
What's going on with the Hagel thing? I mean, I love the team sport that's going on right now. The left, all happy. Oh, he's a great guy. People on the right want to stab him in the back. I'm in the middle. I think he's a decent choice. But I wish that, you know, Obama would have picked, I don't know, a Democrat.
Well, I served in Congress, you know, with Hagel, and I think he's a very decent choice. He's a good guy. John McCain doesn't like him. That ought to make him rise on everybody's list. McCain views him just, you know, quote, too moderate. Hagel used to speak out where he stood on some issues, and especially, for example, on Iran. But you can't criticize him. If you look at the date and the time, you know, Hagel was, there was an outreach by Khatami. He wasn't the crazy lunatic running the country now. And so, you know, people had a little bit different point of view. And I would say Hagel was more like Biden on some of his, you know, international policy. But right now, it's mainly the right that is furious, and he's going to make it through, but he's going to get a lot of hits, as Brennan is, too, with the CIA.
Right.
That's kind of an irony, too. Brennan was 25-year CIA, majority under, what, the two Bushes who were president. But they're sort of acting like he was the director at that time and created all the policy.
Yeah, I look at this, and it's kind of an upside-down world. And there's part of me that goes, did Obama do this just to create that division and get the right kind of eating themselves? Because, you know, I listened to some of the criticisms, especially about Hagel, that, you know, he doesn't hate Castro enough, and he wants to actually talk to people and kind of wants us to mind our own business a little bit. Like, those are bad things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like I said, he's just too moderate for the neocon world. Now, he had the gay slur. That one can't be denied. He doesn't deny it. He did it. And he's apologized. Half of the gay community, this is the other irony, some people in the gay community, quote, on the left, you know, have said, okay, yeah, we don't like it, but, you know, he's apologized and we hope he's learned. The log cabin Republicans are furious on the right side. So this is mainly the right, either way you look at it, whatever the issue is.
Is there any money in it for the log cabin Republicans? Because you would figure that, you know, they would kind of side with all the rest of them, or are they just contrary no matter what, I wonder?
I don't know on this one. This was a bit mixed up. And the choice by President Obama, you know, he served, you know, in the Senate, of course, and Biden served a long time with Hagel. So I don't know if that's part of the factor. You know, he could have found, I would assume, a Democrat that would have some of the same qualifications. But, again, he chose Hagel. I don't think he chose Hagel strictly based on, hey, he's a Republican, I'll get him through easy. I think they knew what was coming.
Yeah. I think part of it was causing that division. But the other part of it, and for me, the reason that I'm not opposed to him, is that he was a guy who was a grunt. I mean, he was on the ground. He may think twice about getting us into some of these excursions overseas, in the next war or wherever we end up.
You've hit the nail on the head on that one because, yes, he was on the ground. He you know, was a guy that has faced combat. Maybe he won't be as quick, you know, to do that. And the other thing, too, the reason the neocons hate him of the right is because, you know, a prerequisite to be a neocon is to be like John Bolton, that you must have a war. I mean, they salivate for a war. And right now we're coming to the end on two wars, and they just kind of need another one.
Now,
and Hagel's not that type of guy.
Yeah, I can't imagine that they're all that thrilled because one of the reports I saw is Obama's – there's actually talk of leaving no troops in Afghanistan.
Yes, they've actually talked about 3,000 to 6,000, and I noticed, I think it was NATO said, well, that's not enough. Well, how much are they going to put in? You know, if they think it's not enough, then how much are they going to put in troop-wise?
No, let somebody else pony up for a change. I'm tired of being the World Cup.
Yeah, are we going to stay there forever? We've been there how long now? You know, well over 11 years, so we're going to stay longer.
Yeah, I like the talking point of, hey, let's start doing some nation building at home. Let's use some of that money to, fix our roads and bridges and invest in our education and maybe some new fangled technology like broadband access across the nation.
I said that once, actually, on a bill and got my finger pointed at me saying, you are a chairman and you cannot be a chairman, you know. That actually happened to me because I questioned the Iraq money at the time years back.
Jeez.
Playgrounds and different things we were doing when we had cutbacks here.
It's just nuts. And with these two nominations, Treasury, to me, that's the next big announcement. Who seems to be the inside name there, do you see?
Well, it's coming, you know, from through the White House, of course, you know, the Chief of Staff. And now the debate on him is, one hand, you know, he's a progressive, Lou. Yeah, he's a progressive. But on the other hand, everybody's calling him, you know, a New York type of guy, because I think he was the top official, what, Citibank, was it?
I think so.
My memory's not serving me right. But I think it was Citibank. And, he's going to be nominated. He's an inside guy. He comes from the White House. Geithner, of course, was controversial. I think he's going to be controversial, too. Doesn't seem like they can actually find somebody that has, you know, a business background, but coming out of Wall Street just is not a positive these days. I don't think so.
No, I can't. That was going to be one of my questions. How is it that we can't find anybody who isn't coming from that background?
I've said that all day and doing news today. When I'm asked about it, I surely there's someone in this country, and they talk about not having a female. There's surely some female in this country that did not walk out of the New York Stock Exchange, but yet knows finances and knows the economy. Surely there's somebody.
It's got to be somebody. But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, we're coming up to the next hostage crisis. The next debt ceiling debacle is due sometime in, what, February?
February, anywhere from February 15th to March the 1st, we start to, quote, default. And now I think Jack Lew, the chief of staff, would be in position by that time. But beyond that, or no, he wouldn't be, would he? We would still have to operate under Geithner, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that would happen yet.
That's true.
There's still that whole confirmation process.
That's right. They'd have that process, so Geithner would still be there.
But what worries me, Bob, is, you know, I'm seeing some of the voices I'm hearing from the Republicans. They almost want another shutdown. They want the Clinton era. They want the sequel. They want to go back and refight that battle, much like some of my Southern friends want to refight the Civil War. They want to refight that battle because they think this time they've learned.
Well, look at Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is, you know, possibly facing Ashley Judd in and this is a political fact, of course, in Kentucky in a general election down the road. But what about a primary? You know, people are seeding at him from the Tea Party movement because he, quote, you know, gave in on the fiscal cliff And McConnell's now saying, well, you know, I compromised on that, but line in the sand. I think you're going to see a full face, face-to-face, aggressive showdown on something that we used to vote on when I was there. I think I voted six times on it. We would yawn and go to dinner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, paying bills for money you've already spent seems kind of logical to me. I mean, if you want to fight over what we're going to spend in the future, that's different. But I think this is something we've already spent, right?
Well, that's right. It has been spent. Correct.
What do you think of the idea? Gerald Nadler came up with this idea that we're going to, and some have called it absurd. You know, he says it's perfectly logical coming up with this trillion-dollar coin.
Oh yeah, the plutonium. Or not plutonium, that's a nuclear weapon, the platinum coin. And it would be worth a trillion and some. And then Congressman Walden has now said, well, we're going to pass a bill against that if he does it.
I've got a compromise.
What's that?
The Republicans have been dying for eons now to put, and in fact, I remember the whole movement to get FDR kicked off the dime, and they wanted to put Reagan's mug on there. Oh. I'm in favor of let's make the trillion-dollar coin, but put Reagan's face on it.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good compromise.
It's a win-win.
That'll work. Yes.
This way they get what they wanted. They wanted Reagan's face on money.
That's right. That one will work.
How is this possible? I mean, how is it possible that they can just make a coin and say, oh, this is worth $1 trillion, we're putting it is it possible, and how is it possible?
Well, technically it is. I mean, it technically can be done, but, they're not going to do it. I mean, it technically can be minted, made, and paid, but they're not going to do it.
Right. Well, because, you know, I'm looking at this from Obama's perspective. You know, what would I do if I'm him? You know, there's talk of the 14th Amendment saying, you know what, we're just going to pay our bills. This debt ceiling is nonsense. We're going to do what we have to do. Or, you know, one of these gimmicky things. You know, what's he to do? If really the Republicans want the government shut down, they want to go through this, and the scorched earth mentality that I do see coming, what could he do?
Well, I mean, they've got to make some type of, I think, sit-down arrangements, and in a sense of trying to talk about comprehensively how they're going to solve this thing.
Yeah, the hope is that rational people will, rational, what the hell am I talking about? I look at this fight, this discussion over, really not a discussion, this shouting match over guns. I don't know if you saw the CNN thing with Alex Jones, where he, and Piers Morgan, where, I think Alex.
Oh, yes, you know me, where the petition where he's going to be,
deported.
He has to go to President Obama.
Yeah, where Alex Jones, the talk radio guy, wants Piers Morgan deported back to.
Exactly.
And as I watched, I don't know if you saw the video. Did you see it?
No, of him on the show?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I just saw a brief beginning, but no, I didn't see it.
Alex Jones is, to me, watching him on that show, is the reason we need to have mental health testing for gun owners. I mean, he's a guy who really, I mean, he looked completely unhinged, completely someone you don't want walking around with a gun. And then the part of me that has, you know, I've met him. He seems like a reasonable guy. Doesn't seem like a true believer to me. Seems like a guy working an angle, and you knew he was probably going to go unhinged there.
Well, I think he was surprised he got the signatures for this to be considered.
Well,
he was supposed to get 25,000 to 100,000, but he doesn't. I don't know what. It's not going to deport.
Oh, of course not. But you know, it's for me. You know, I look at this, and they're making a big deal out of this. With a lot of my gun friends, they want to take our guns, and I'm going, I don't hear anybody really talking about taking your guns.
Well, Kathy Giffords, you know, who was shot, the former congresswoman, she's got this group, and it's trying to take a. It's not saying take the guns. And I think it's probably even, it's going to come off as a lot more reasonable approach than Brady, let's say. But it's not a gun grab thing. They're not going to collect guns in this country.
No, they're not.
But they're going to put forth some type of reasonable solution, what she's looking for.
Is there, from a Republican standpoint, I mean, you were a longtime Republican, probably still are, is there reasonable ground here? Or is the NRA position of any restriction whatsoever is unconstitutional and we're never going to allow anything to happen?
Well, I think people today would consider, you know, automatic weapons would be considered. I think there's got to be a debate on, a discussion on mental health also. That's got to be part of the picture, and that's fair and legitimate.
Yeah. I mean, are automatic weapons legal now, though?
Well, what they would have to do, well, yeah, I mean, there's previous bans on them, you know, a ban on them that then went out. But I think that they're talking about, you know, how many ammunition, limiting amounts of the clip action, how many bullets can be in a clip. Feinstein talked about 10. So I think they're going to try to come up with some numbers, probably.
It'll be interesting. And the one good thing about it is the NRA will raise tons of money off of it.
And they're all going to go crazy with this one. This one's, you know, this has had a kind of a 30-day, you know, cooling off period, seriously, with the vice president looking into this. And, you know, but one more rampage will reignite it.
Yeah. Although we could have cops in every classroom, like Sheriff Arpaio is doing down there in Arizona. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. Bob Ney, I appreciate
Thank
the time.
You, sir.
Great talking
right.
with you.
Thanks.
Let's Goodbye. Take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky. We don't just live in a spiral galaxy. We live in a barred spiral galaxy.
In other words, our galaxy has a central bar-shaped structure, like a straight stick in the middle, composed of stars. But until recently, scientists didn't know which Milky Way stars are part of the bar. Now, an international team of astronomers says it has found hundreds of stars rapidly moving together in long, looping orbits around the center of our Milky Way. They think these stars are part of the Milky Way's central bar.
These astronomers use data from a large survey project called Apogee, which uses a telescope in New Mexico. The data showed them the velocities of nearly 5,000 stars near the Milky Way's center. A substantial fraction of those stars were moving away from us quickly.
Then they compared these observations with computer models of the Milky Way's central bar. They concluded that the stars they were measuring, those fleeing from Earth, are part of the bar. They said that these stars are in the part of the bar rotating away from our direction in space.
But that's just one side of the bar of the Milky Way center. On the other side of the bar, the stars must be moving toward Earth. The other half of the Milky Way central bar is visible only from Earth's southern hemisphere. That's why these astronomers plan to use a telescope in Chile to observe the rest of the inner Milky Way, beginning in 2014. We have more at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Yeah, we could all be idiotic like that. And imagine, that woman is a state representative. I mean, that just blows my mind. That, oh, wow, you know, we took money out, but then we put it back. Yeah, well, we were going to take $2 billion. We only took $1 billion out, so we put money back. No, you took $1 billion out. And I guess part of me goes, that's what's happened to our education system. We've taught regurgitation and not critical thinking. Oh, they put money back. Not all of it. It's like the thing with AIG or the banks. Yeah, they stole a bunch of money, but they paid some of it back. Come on, they paid some. AIG saying, well, we paid it all back with interest, but we're going to sue you because of it. Just mind-blowing. I mean, just nuts. Just absolutely nuts. And to think that, you know, Anyway, yesterday I deliberately decided not to talk about this story. And, you know, it's one of these things that we see on a regular basis. It's become a regular occurrence that the obnoxious and the idiotic get attention. And then they rile up the simple-minded. And it's basically just a sales gimmick. It's just a, hey, look at me, buy my stuff, because, you know, them. There's a Mexican restaurant down in Columbia, South Carolina, who evidently forced their workers to wear a T-shirt with a picture of a box, you know, kind of the old wooden trap idea, you know, how you catch a rabbit, like, you know, have this big crate with a stick and, you know, put some, you know, carrots under there, and so the rabbit goes and you pull the stick out and it comes out. Well, no, they've decided that they're going to put a taco under the box with the caption of how to catch an illegal immigrant. Oh, they're going to be dumb enough to go into the box and get the taco, and we're going to, it's funny. So Think Progress, you know, found this out. You know, it was flagged by the Palmetto Public Record. So Think Progress throws it out there and points out that, you know, this is a one-star restaurant that is shrinking. You know, basically it's a crummy restaurant. It used to have four locations. It's now down to one. And you know, when I saw the story, I said, you know, this is just a ploy. You gotta get the angry, jingoistic, idiotic, disposable income crowd to go, hey, they're standing up for good Americans. We're gonna go support them. And it's a ploy. It's a gimmick. It's a game. Because they want you to go, well, because, you know, it's going to be like Gun Appreciation Day, because we want it to be like Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day, because they saw the idiotics come out and say, we're going to go against those squares, and we're going to go eat chicken. Yeah, you figure that one out, because I still can't. So, you know, this restaurant got the attention that it wanted, got a couple of stories, got people, we're going to support this idiotic taco joint. So they come out and they say, well, you know, our shirts, you know, it was comical. It was a comical statement. Come on, it was funny. Isn't that funny? Oh, yeah, it's funny. And I'm going, you know, I'm so sick of this. I'm so sick of being sucked into this. But it really, it goes to show, you know, what is funny? That ain't it. And we've got to be, and I'm not going to name the name of the place. I'm not giving them any type of publicity whatsoever. But other than this is a failing business who's decided, well, you know what, we gotta get some attention. And what better way than to use immigrants? Well, they're illegals. What? Brought in by our big corporations, you know, the corporate people. Just nuts to me. And the other part of this is, you know, if you're going to work for these people, you have to wear that shirt. Again, if you had a contract, something you could probably negotiate. And, oh, my favorite part, and I'm hoping they get sued over this, as the people at Think Progress pointed out, they basically stole the design from an online apparel designer. So the hope is that they get sued over it, and good for them. And finally, our last story of the day, for those of you who have dogs, you know, I had a dog for a while, and love dogs. If you want to get them some non-alcoholic beer, now someone has decided that there should be a non-alcoholic beer for dogs. It's called Dog Grog, and you can get it in Oregon. And the guy who developed it said, there was a lot of stuff left over at the place where he works in the tasting room. And me doth thinketh he tasteth too much. Just a thought. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway.